How a few tenacious lawyers fought to apprehend a man suspected of orchestrating the deaths of thousands of people.
I just simplistically thought that he was no longer head of state and therefore he wouldn't have immunity.
Suddenly, overnight, the strategy of the prosecuting office changes.
The Arrest on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 28th of November. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Amol Rajan in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. Labour MPs have criticised the government's U-turn on its manifesto commitment to protect workers from unfair dismissal from their first day in a job. And President Trump has said he plans to suspend migration to the US from what he called third world countries after the death of a soldier allegedly shot by an Afghan national in Washington.
Also in today's programme, David Dimbleby joins us to talk about his new series, which asks, what's the monarchy for? After yesterday's migration figures, why are many young people leaving Britain?
I've met some of my best friends here. I've met my partner here. So just the quality of life, I've got no reason to go back to the UK at the moment.
And remember this. Forty years since Saturday night staple Blind Date first aired, we'll speak to the couple who married after meeting on the show in the 1980s. And you know what? They're still together. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs over the government's decision to abandon a manifesto pledge to give workers protection from unfair dismissal from their first day in the job. Ministers now plan to introduce the right after 6 months, following opposition from the House of Lords. Business groups have backed the change, but a number of Labour backbenchers have expressed concern at what the Conservatives have described as another humiliating U-turn. Here's our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus.
What Labour had promised, the Middlesbrough MP Andy McDonald said, was the biggest uplift to workers' rights in a generation. But what had been agreed now was a complete betrayal. The Poole MP Neil Duncan Jordan said the Lords did not have primacy over a manifesto commitment and asked why the government had capitulated. At present, workers can only take their employer to a tribunal for unfair dismissal if they've been in the job for 2 years. The manifesto pledge was to make that available from day one. But with the Lords holding up the legislation, the government has got more than a dozen businesses and union groups, including the TUC, to agree to a compromise where the right will kick in after 6 months. Both sides say they have sought to cooperate so the bill can be passed. The government will be hoping the support from the unions will blunt the criticism from Labour MPs.
President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration to the US from what he called third world countries. In a lengthy social media post, he also said he would end all federal benefits to non-citizens and denaturalise migrants who undermine domestic tranquility. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
President Trump posted his comments hours after he announced the death of Sarah Beckstrom, one of two National Guards shot during an attack near the White House on Wednesday. Authorities say the suspected gunman is an Afghan national. The president's language is highly inflammatory. Mr. Trump says immigration policies have eroded living conditions for many Americans and claims most of the 53 million foreign nationals living in the US are, in his words, on welfare from failed nations or from prisons, mental institutions, gangs or drug cartels. Earlier, the US government said it intended to review the immigration status of green card holders from 19 countries who have previously been granted the permanent right to live and work in the US. Officials did not set out any details and haven't released any official list of countries whose nationals would be affected.
The Labour chair of the Commons International Development Committee has warned that plans to cut almost 2,000 staff at the Foreign Office could have life or death implications for some of the world's poorest people. Sarah Champion also said the UK's global reputation would be put at risk by the loss of expertise at the department. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The Foreign Office is in the process of shedding around a quarter of its UK-based staff, including a significant number of senior officials. The Labour MP, Sarah Champion, who chairs the International Development Committee, says lives could be at stake as a result, along with the UK's global reputation. In a letter to the Foreign Secretary, she says the department's failure to explain why it's cutting so many posts could lead to an exodus of staff, deterioration in morale, and possibly even represent a breach of employment protocol. A Foreign Office spokesperson said the UK remained committed to international development, but that the department was transitioning to a leaner, more agile workforce.
The authorities in Hong Kong have announced that firefighting operations have ended at the territory's worst blaze in decades. At least 94 people are confirmed to have died in the fire, which engulfed several tower blocks and a housing complex. Almost 300 people are still unaccounted for. A BBC investigation into breast cancer care provided by County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust has found that more than 200 patients have been harmed since 2023, including 43 who suffered significant harms. Previous reports have highlighted problems including missed cancers and mastectomies that may not have been necessary. Steve Russell, who's the newly appointed head of the Trust, says action should have been taken sooner.
It was not good enough, and it is not good enough, that we were too slow to act on the information that was there. I can only imagine the distress, the anger, the loss of trust that women will feel in the NHS and in our organisation. And I'm determined to make changes so that that doesn't happen again.
The BBC has discovered that more than 1,000 adopted children in the UK were returned to care in the past 5 years, with parents and whistleblowers highlighting a culture of blame and lies in the system. Some adoptive parents have told File on 4 Investigates that they were forced to hand back children because they didn't receive enough support. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
We spoke to more than 50 parents, most of whom said they felt they had no option than to return at least one child to care. Many reported that their children had complex issues which were not made clear when they were placed for adoption and were then denied subsequent support and blamed when they could no longer cope. A quarter had been arrested after their children made untrue allegations about them. A whistleblower has highlighted a culture of social workers blaming adoptive parents for their children's difficulties. The Department for Education said support was in place to help adoptive families and keep them together where possible, and they aim to transform children's social care with future legislation.
Adoption, the Blame Game, is available now on BBC Sounds. The number of cars built in the UK fell by nearly a quarter in October compared to the same month last year. Figures from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders show production was down by 23.8%, with around 59,000 cars rolling out of factories. The Society said the sector was continuing to feel the effects of a cyber attack on Jaguar Land Rover and warned that future demand would be undermined by the government's new tax on electric vehicles.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 7 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to Simon King, who's got the weather. Simon, how are you?
Good morning, ML. Yes, all good, thank you. We've got some strong winds today, especially so towards northern parts of the UK. Some severe gales, actually, in the far north and the west of Scotland. Quite unsettled today. There'll be some showers in the forecast. So for eastern and southeast England, here we have got some higher cloud this morning, but generally it's going to be a fairly bright and then sunny start to the day. The cloud will tend to increase into this afternoon, and eventually we'll see a few showers moving in right at the end of the day, quite breezy with temperatures of 12 or 13 degrees. In southwest England, Wales, and across northern England, quite a lot of dry and bright weather this morning, but there is an area of showers just sitting around the North Sea at the moment, the Irish Sea, that's going to move into parts of northwest England, North Wales in the next few hours, and then gradually spread its way further south and eastward into southwest England, into the Midlands, and into northeast England as well. So some of these showers could be heavy, perhaps even a bit thundery. Later on, there'll be some sunny spells returning towards northern or western areas. Quite gusty winds, especially around those coastal areas of Wales and western England. Temperatures about 9 to 12 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, sunny spells with blustery showers here, temperatures of 9 or 10 degrees. And for Scotland, very strong winds, especially in the far north and west of Scotland, gusts 70, 75 miles an hour. Those winds could cause some disruption, but they will gradually ease today. Lots of heavy showers, some thunderstorms moving in, merging into longer spells of rain, a little bit drier towards southern and eastern Scotland, and temperatures of 6 to 9 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. It's definitely autumnal now, isn't it? Just coming round to 9 minutes past six. Let's take a first look at the front pages of the morning papers. And Sir Keir Starmer is facing a revolt from his MPs after the U-turn on workers being able to claim unfair dismissal from day one. This is according to The Times this morning, which quotes an unnamed minister describing the climb down as total self-destruction, and Unite's General Secretary Sharon Graham calling the Employment Rights Bill a shell of its former self. The Daily Telegraph headline states that Starmer rips up Rayner's rights bill and calls it a second manifesto breach in as many days. But The Guardian notes that the TUC is prepared to accept the compromise as it wants to get other rights like day one sick pay onto the statute books.
The Daily Telegraph claims the Telegraph claims that young workers are fleeing what it calls Labour's high-tax Britain, with under-35s leading a near-record exodus. The paper reports on ONS figures which suggest that those aged between 16 to 34 make up two-thirds of departing Britons. Leading with a story, the Daily Mail calls the number of young people leaving the UK a brain drain which threatens to add to the pain of what it describes as Rachel Reeves' disastrous budget.
The Daily Express highlights the latest stage of the assisted dying bill, which is to be debated by the House of Lords early next year. The paper quotes campaigners criticising opponents for tabling dozens of amendments which could cause delays and accusing peers of stealing precious time and choice from those who are terminally ill.
The Daily Mirror claims to have an exclusive on the 1999 unsolved fatal shooting of the BBC presenter Jill Dando. With the headline tied to murder, the paper says a newly unearthed photo of a Serbian assassin is being assessed by detectives as he appears to be wearing a similar tie to a man caught on CCTV near the crime scene.
And archaeologists believe that a circle of pits near Stonehenge were created by Neolithic people who were interested in the underworld, apparently, so reports The Guardian this morning. These 20 pits, which are spread about a mile across, were first revealed back in 2020. But the paper says that new research has concluded that they were made by humans rather than being natural features, as some people have previously thought.
Interesting. 11 minutes past six. Let's turn to another one of the big stories from this week's budget, in danger of being missed, actually. It's what's happening with SEND provision, that's special educational needs. The Chancellor announced that the government would take over full responsibility from local councils. But how much will this cost and where will the money come from? Vanessa Clark is our education correspondent. Vanessa, good morning.
Good morning.
So what's the basic change that was announced by the Chancellor this week, and what are the concerns that 48 hours on or so people are starting to have?
Yeah, well, really, I think this is an accounting change, but quite an important one. So councils, as we know, are stretched and some have overspent on their SEND budgets. But an agreement was reached where this deficit would be kept off the books until 2028, basically to stop them going into bankruptcy. Now, we still don't know what will happen to that debt once that ring fencing ends, you know, if it will be written off. But what we do know is that the government have now said from that point, 2028, all spending on SEND will come out of departmental budgets, so within government. And the Office for Budget Responsibility was very clear in its assessment that this will create a £6 billion funding hole, really, on SEND spending, which will increase over the years. And it said the government hasn't indicated what savings will be made in order to fund this. And if, and the big word here is if that money had to be taken from school budgets, it would lead to an almost 5% fall in spending per pupil. That's their warning. Now, the Department for Education has strongly refuted those predictions. They say, firstly, that any shortfall would be absorbed within the overall government budget. So it's not really clear if it would come under the education budget specifically, but it does seem the most likely place. And secondly, there is a big SEND white paper due next year, which will lay out what changes they are going to make in the system. And the government says the OBR's prediction have not really taken into account those changes, whatever they may be. So we've two very different views there.
Vanessa, it's very interesting. It'll be of a huge concern, obviously, to parents of pupils who receive SEND provision. Thank you, Vanessa. We'll come back to this story before 7 o'clock.
It's 13 minutes past six now. A BBC investigation has found more than 200 breast cancer patients in County Durham have suffered harm in their treatment. It was significant harm for 43 of them. One death is also being investigated. Our health correspondent Sharon Barber has been looking into this. Sharon, this is a huge shock for patients of that trust.
Absolutely. It's actually a huge shock across the northeast, and especially for the women who thought they were alone in their traumatic experiences. But the County Durham and Dallington Trust has been coming under increasing scrutiny with a number of highly critical reports, including earlier this year from the Royal College of Surgeons. That was a catalogue of serious failings in the treatment of breast cancer patients across County Durham. So the Trust has apologised to patients, including to Kate Driver. She was 29 when she found a lump in her breast. She went to the GP. They sent her to one of these urgent two-week wait breast clinics for investigations, but it turned out to be a private clinic, and it was run for the Trust by their top breast surgeon, who was then the clinical lead. He ran two clinics for the Trust on a paid per patient or paid per procedure basis. Companies that were paid nearly £6 million in the last 6 years. So in Kate's case, she underwent a test for cancer that was outdated. Her diagnosis was delayed for months. When she finally was told that she needed a mastectomy, she was wrongly told that she couldn't have reconstruction at the same time.
Waiting so long and having to chase everything up made it 100 times worse than it needed to be. I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep. It just made it felt like no one really cared. No one was taking it seriously. I thought I was going to die. And that was the scariest, really like the hardest bit, I think. Kind of just being faced with your own mortality.
Well, Kate transferred her care to Newcastle. She had immediate reconstruction. She feels she had a lucky escape. But we've learned that the mastectomy rate in County Durham was very high and the reconstruction rate was very low.
And how long do these problems date back, Sharon?
Well, our investigation found that the problems actually date back to 2012. There have been a number of stark warnings before the Royal College of Surgeons report, including in 2019, a really damning report from NHS England's Getting It Right First Time team. But these warnings weren't acted on. So the new chief executive, Steve Russell, who started in September, has now admitted to the BBC that they missed those warnings, and that's had terrible consequences for the women of County Durham.
It was not good enough, and it is not good enough that we were too slow to act on the information that was there. I can only imagine the distress, the anger, the loss of trust that women will feel in the NHS and in our organisation. And I'm determined to make changes so that that doesn't happen again.
Well, NHS England and the Care Quality Commission are now involved in ongoing investigations. And for women affected, a helpline's been set up by the hospital.
Thank you, Sharon, for that. You can find out more about Sharon's investigation. There's a documentary now on iPlayer. It's called Hidden Scars, an NHS Scandal.
16 minutes past six, time to say good morning to Fliss, who has the business in Salford. Hi, Fliss.
Morning, yes. And talking this morning about what's making a lot of the front pages today, the fact that the government has U-turned on one of its pledges for workers in its employment rights bill. Ministers say the change is to stop the legislation being delayed in the House of Lords, where it's run into some opposition. Now, I should say this bill applies to England, Scotland and Wales, but not Northern Ireland, where employment law is devolved. Now, essentially, it proposed changes to minimum wages, 0 hours contracts, and a move to give workers rights like parental leave, sick pay, and protection from unfair dismissal from day one. As things stand at the moment, workers get that protection from unfair dismissal after 2 years. Now, instead of making it a day one right, which was proposed in Labour's manifesto, the government has agreed the protection will only come in after 6 months. Let's talk to Martin McTague, who's National Chair of the Federation of Small Businesses. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
Were your members worried about a day one right to protect against unfair dismissal, and will they welcome this change?
They were extremely worried. I mean, we got some of the highest recorded concerns in our surveys. 92% said they were worried about it. A third had already decided to reduce headcount. So it was the most serious part of this potential bill.
Now, day one protection against discrimination already exists, and that remains. Other new day one rights to sick pay and paternity leave will still go ahead. They come into effect, or will come into effect, in April next year. Do businesses agree with those reforms?
Yeah, well, most of the day one rights nobody was arguing with, but what it was extending those day one rights for everybody. And that meant that you had lots of cases where employers were thinking about taking people on, but suddenly the risks had become extremely high. And they decided that it was just too risky to take people on. And you had a stall in recruitment. And I think the only way they could restore confidence was this change, which is a pragmatic change. And it had support right across parties throughout the Lords.
Okay, so does it go far enough, do you think? Are there still things in the bill that you would like to change?
This was by far and away the most important thing. The other issues that are likely to cost small businesses money are things like statutory sick pay and we're asking the government to seriously consider rebates. If they want to extend those rights, then they should consider ways in which they can protect the smallest employers. But, you know, I can't emphasise too much that this part of the bill was the most important thing to put right.
Okay, well, I mean, some unions sort of agree with this, and okay, fine, it can get through the House of Lords and come onto the books. Some unions have said, well, this bill is now watered down. You know, flexible working will become the default, but there are still a huge number of reasons why an employer can refuse. Fire and rehire has been banned in most circumstances, but it is still possible if a company is at risk of insolvency. Are the new rules really going to make a huge difference to employers?
Yeah, they would have made an enormous difference. But the other thing that people have constantly said is that this somehow gave justice to people who had a dispute at work. Well, the reality is employment tribunals are swamped with cases, and that justice wouldn't have applied. And what it would have meant was lots of people who were furthest from the workforce, who had found it difficult to get jobs under normal circumstances, would have definitely been excluded from any opportunity for new work.
Well, the government has said the measures in the bill mark the biggest upgrade to rights at work for a generation. And you can see why some workers might think it's entirely fair they should have more employee protections from the beginning of their employment, and that they might need that kind of certainty so they can actually accept a new job, go and look for a new role.
Yeah, well, they've got protections from day one right now. But what we were saying is if you've got a small business that doesn't have HR resources and has to make a decision in a fairly informal way, if they're faced with this kind of complication, where if they make a decision, they could be spending years in tribunals and thousands of pounds on legal fees, they would just not recruit. So the pragmatic response, and one I think lots of trade unions realise, is that you had to extend that to 6 months. 6 months was a sensible compromise, and it was a year with the last Labour government. This is now 6 months. It's a sensible place in which to land.
Martin McTague, National Chair of the Federation of Small Businesses, thank you very much indeed. Now, two household names from the world of US banking are to increase their investments in the UK. JP Morgan will build a new London HQ in Canary Wharf, and Goldman Sachs is to double its UK workforce at its Birmingham office from 500 to 1,000 staff. Zoe Gillespie is investment manager at RBC Brewin Dolphin. Joins me now. Zoe, morning.
Good morning.
How significant is this?
Well, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said the decision was a multi-billion pound vote of confidence in the UK economy. And I think certainly after Wednesday's budget, it was a very much welcome decision from both banks and to show that there is confidence in the UK economy. And as Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, said, certainly he was very confident in the UK's government's priority for economic growth. So I think it's a huge, as you say, vote of confidence for UK PLC.
Let's also talk about Debenhams Group. It's had some pretty decent results, actually. The online fashion retailer that used to be known as Boohoo. Revenue wasn't great, but the chain has managed to bring costs under control.
Yeah, I think that was the big takeaway, was the fact that the statutory loss after tax has gone to 3.4 million, which was 97% lower than the 126.7 million reported for the first half of the year. So I think certainly there's a turnaround story there. But as we've seen with a lot of online retailers, it's a highly competitive market, and there was a reduction in revenue. So I think the share price reacted positively to the news, and maybe more to come.
There was some controversy, though, wasn't there, over bonuses for senior managers?
Yeah, there was. And I think certainly there's been ongoing kind of friction between management there. So I think that's another story that we're going to see potentially play out as part of the control of the company and the future direction.
Zoe Gillespie, Investment Manager at RBC Brewin Dolphin. Thank you very much indeed. Let's have a bit more budget fallout now. The government is facing criticism from the hospitality sector over a major cut in support for some businesses. Pubs, restaurants and shops are facing a steep rise in business rates next April. This is after their 40% discount will be replaced with a much smaller reduction, worth just 5p in the pound. Now, combined with rising property valuations, one estimate from the global tax firm Ryan suggests the average pub could see more than a 65% rise in business rates bills. Let's talk to Phil Thorley, who's the owner of Thorley Taverns, which operates 18 pubs in the southeast of England. Phil, good morning. Have you checked your new rateable values? Do you know how much this is going to cost you?
Morning, Felicity. Thank you very much for having me on, because I think it's vital that your listeners, our customers and my staff know what this budget is going to mean to the British pub. Yes, we have gone through. We've got 18 sites and we've got 17 of them where the rateable value has gone north. And what it means to a small little family company like ours is that our actual payable rent rates is going to be going up by some 27%, a further £62,000 worth of costs onto the business, which is absolutely at its knees at the moment, Felicity.
Now, there are quite a few changes, I suppose, affecting you. Minimum wage increases, these business rates changes, new rateable values. What kind of pressure does it put you under?
It's unbelievable pressure at the moment. In this particular budget, following on from last year's budget, which I quoted as being the worst in my 40 years of running pubs, is that business rates have gone up. Staffing costs have gone up. Staffing costs for teenagers and young people have gone up by 8.5%, increased on duty. This is over and above what's happening with utilities and food and drink costs, which are also going north. Okay. Now, what does that mean to us? That's going to mean less employment, less investment, less training in the people that we've got, and less jobs for young people. And jobs for young people is absolutely vital, Felicity.
No business likes it when they have to pay more, do they? But it was always clear that the retail, hospitality and leisure discount to business rates was a temporary relief. It was brought in during COVID. It was reduced in last year's budget. It would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that your sector benefited from it for a number of years and always knew that it wasn't going to last forever.
We were the sector that was shut down by the government. We didn't absolutely boom during the COVID years, such as the supermarkets did. And when you look at what's gone on, some of our pubs have gone up in the country, have gone up by 300% the rateable value. There's an Amazon warehouse in Banbury that's gone up 6%. Now, Rachel said she wanted a rebalance from high street to online businesses. However, what she's done is she's rebalanced from online businesses to high street. It's absolutely outrageous. And I think it's going to be the death knell to the British pub.
Well, a Treasury spokesperson said, we're protecting pubs, restaurants and cafes with the budget's £4.3 billion support package, capping bills, saving most typical independent pubs £4,800 next year. And they said that comes on top of cutting the licensing cost of licensing to help more offer pavement drinks and alfresco dining and keeping their cut to alcohol duty on draft pints and capping corporation tax. Some people listening will think you do have quite a lot of help.
It's absolutely small beer. And I'd really love that government spokesperson to come and sit at my desk and talk to the 350 people that I employ who are vital to our business. Our business, we've got some great sites on clifftops, on beaches. We have lots and lots of lovely customers, but we have nothing without our team members. And if we can't afford to employ those team members, that government analyst knows nothing. Come in the real world. Come to where we run pubs. Come to where the area is. It's vital that pubs exist in local communities, and really they're trying to put a nail in the coffin, Felicity.
Phil Thorley, owner of Thorley Taverns, thank you very much indeed.
Fliss, thank you very much indeed. It is just coming up to 28 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to Mike Williams, who's got the sport.
Good morning, Amal. This time next week, the second Ashes test will definitely be underway. It'll be day two, which if the first test is anything to go by, it could well all be over by. But let's not be pessimistic. But we have had some breaking team news overnight for that match. And Australia will again be without fast bowler Pat Cummings for the day-nighter at the Gabba. The captain continues to recover from a back injury. Let's get the latest from the BBC's Stefan Schemmelt in Brisbane.
All the signs were Cummins would return for the day-nighter in Brisbane. He looked to be bowling at top pace in the nets around the first test in Perth, and again this week back at home in Sydney. But the captain has not completed the rehab programme required to play in a test match. He now has almost 3 weeks to get ready for the third test in Adelaide. Opener Usman Khawaja is in the squad, and Australia must decide if he retains his place in the 11. England return to training on Saturday, when captain Ben Stokes will break a week-long media silence.
Yes, as we say, the second Ashes test getting underway 4 a.m. next Thursday. Let's switch to football now. Plenty of European action to rattle through. Let's start in the Netherlands, where Celtic came from behind to earn a famous 3-1 win over Feyenoord in what was almost certainly interim manager Martin O'Neill's last match in charge. The new Celtic manager, Wilfred Nancy, is expected to arrive this weekend in Glasgow. So after 5 wins from his 6 matches in charge, what will the 73-year-old O'Neill do now?
I shall go back into the sunset, you know, and finish off that coffee that I was having down the King's Road 4 odd weeks ago.
It'll be freezing by now.
It will be freezing. I'll get another one. And then I'll sit back and watch from a distance again.
Does it give you a renewed sense of something about the game, or does it make you think, right, enough?
Right, OK, it's a very good point. When I see young people, it does refresh you. You're in among young people and you don't really feel your age. So that's the great thing about it. And it's lovely. It really is genuinely lovely.
And that is Martin O'Neill speaking to Connie McLaughlin on TNT Sport last night. Elsewhere, Rangers drew 1-1 at home to Braga. Aston Villa beat the Swiss side Young Boys 2-1 at Villa Park, whilst Sean Dyche's Nottingham Forest were comfortable 3-0 home winners over the Swedish club Malmo.
They didn't offer too much in the sense of a real attacking threat, but that doesn't mean that the game's easy. You know, you've still got to find ways to score a goal, and I'm really pleased with the different styles of goal we found tonight.
Whilst in the Conference League, defeat for Crystal Palace last night. They lost 2-1 away to Strasbourg in France, whilst Aberdeen drew 1-1 with Noah. And finally, away from football, the penultimate race weekend of the 2025 Formula One season gets underway in Qatar later today. The title could be clinched this weekend. A reminder, we actually have a 3-way fight for the championship. So let's briefly hear from all 3 title contenders in this order. The McLaren pair of Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, followed by the 4-time defending champion Max Verstappen.
I don't mind. Of course, the earlier I can do it, the better. But at the same time, that doesn't change how I do anything. I just need to try and win, and simple as that.
I think a lot of things have unfolded differently to how I'd hoped or how I expected in the second half of the year, but there's nothing I can do to change that now. So I'm just trying to focus on how I can finish the year on a high.
It's still open, and of course, yeah, we'll try our best. You know, we'll go all in, and hopefully, we can make it exciting till the end.
Yeah, big weekend for those 3, Norris, Piastri and Verstappen. The Qatar Grand Prix is on Sunday. First practice for that gets underway this afternoon, 1:30. You can hear it on BBC Sounds.
Ooh, the tension. Thank you, Mike.
He had green hair and very bad teeth.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Join Gina Birch from the Raincoast.
I saw firsthand how their magnetism tore through British culture.
And me, Steve Lamacq, as we explore one of Britain's most notorious bands.
4 members, no egos.
That shocked the nation.
They are the antithesis of humankind.
Defined punk and tore themselves apart.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Search Sex Pistols on BBC Sounds.
Now the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Amal Rajan in London, and a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs over the government's decision to abandon a manifesto pledge to give workers protection from unfair dismissal from their first day in the job. Ministers now plan to introduce the right after 6 months. Business groups have backed the change, but several Labour backbenchers have expressed concern at what the Conservatives have called another humiliating U-turn. President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration from what he called third world countries after 2 National Guard soldiers were shot on Wednesday. Last night he announced one of the soldiers, 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom, had died. The main suspect in the shooting is a 29-year-old man from Afghanistan. The Labour chair of the Commons International Development Committee has warned that plans to cut almost 2,000 staff at the Foreign Office could have life or death implications for some of the world's poorest people. Sarah Champion also said the UK's global reputation would be put at risk by the loss of expertise at the department. The Foreign Office said it was transitioning to a more agile workforce. Firefighters in Hong Kong have ended operations at the territory's worst blaze in decades. At least 94 people are confirmed to have died in the fire, which engulfed several tower blocks in a housing complex. Almost 300 people are still unaccounted for. A BBC investigation into breast cancer care provided by County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust has found that more than 200 patients have been harmed since 2023, including 43 who suffered significant harms. The Trust has apologised after warnings were missed and is asking concerned patients to call its helpline. It's emerged that more than 1,000 adopted children in the UK were returned to care in the past 5 years, with parents and whistleblowers highlighting a culture of blame and lies in the system. Some adoptive parents have told File on 4 Investigates that they were forced to hand back children because they didn't receive enough support. The Department for Education said it aimed to transform children's social care with future legislation.
Thank you, Jane. It is 26 minutes to seven. The government's changing its plans to give protection against unfair dismissal to employees from their first day in the job, but it's had a mixed response, it's fair to say. Ian Watson, our political correspondent, is with us. Morning, Ian.
Morning, Anna.
Business is quite happy. Some Labour MPs very much not so.
Yes, I'm afraid it's not the most exciting thing to say at this time of the morning, but I think the reaction has actually been quite predictable so far. Business groups think this is a decent compromise. The Conservatives say, actually, it's a U-turn, so the government isn't giving you the stability that it promised, but also it should be doing a bigger U-turn on the Employment Rights Bill because this will destroy jobs. And, of course, from the left of the Labour Party, there are talk of betrayal and a sellout. I think, however, there are still some dangers here for Keir Starmer over this compromise. The first is, quite straightforwardly, that so far, although the voices of criticism have been on the left of the party, we haven't yet heard from Angela Rayner, the person who, in opposition, drew up the plans for workers' rights. One of her allies, who was sacked in the recent reshuffle, Justin Madders, does sound very critical of this U-turn himself. So this could be a growing problem inside the Labour Party. I think it's just too soon to say on that front. It could also be a financial problem for the Labour Party because although the TUC, the umbrella group for the trade unions, has said this is a decent compromise, the Unite trade union, which gives more than £1 million a year to the Labour Party, is already reviewing those financial links. They've said the employment rights legislation is now a shell of its former self. So this might speed up the process by which they loosen their links and perhaps withdraw their financial cash from Labour. It is a breach of Labour's manifesto, there's no doubt about that, but I think what ministers would point out is that many other day one rights on parental leave, for example, on sick pay, will be going ahead. And also we should remember that although this will now be a 6-month qualifying period before you can claim unfair dismissal, it's currently 2 years, so it still does actually represent an improvement.
Ian Watson, thank you. We'll discuss this in just under an hour's time with one of those Labour MPs who is unhappy about rowing back on that manifesto pledge and the General Secretary of the TUC as well on why they decided to come to a compromise over it.
24 minutes to 7, President Putin has said there's no point signing a peace deal with the current Ukrainian leadership because it is illegitimate. A team of US negotiators is due to arrive in Moscow next week to try to renew talks on ending the conflict. Let's speak to James Waterhouse, our correspondent in Kyiv. James, morning again from London. Here we are again. Is this time any different? Is there any reason to think that these talks could succeed but others have failed?
I hear what you're saying, Mol. You know, it does feel like we are in this diplomatic quicksand where, you know, America sides with Russia, Ukraine and Europe muscles in. And the question is what America then does next. I think, yes, we did hear Vladimir Putin reiterate his red lines, try to delegitimize Ukraine's leadership, referencing Ukraine's need to relinquish the land it occupies, in his words, presumably referencing the eastern Donbass region. But I'm just reading an interview by Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, a key negotiator in this process. He's spoken to The Atlantic and he has reiterated Ukraine's lines. He said no sane person would sign an agreement that would give up land. He says the discussion needs to be framed around what land is currently controlled by the warring side. So I guess to answer your question this morning, the difference is, it seems, both the Kremlin and Kyiv are still keen to buy into this process. I mean, Putin said, you know, there need to be detailed discussions. No final version exists yet. But of course, from this side of the the scarred border, it is viewed as Moscow simply trying to buy more time, because clearly the Kremlin is happy with how this war is going.
I know I always ask you this, James, because for our listeners who aren't following the war closely but want a sense of it, what's actually happening on the ground? Where is this kind of conflict, this attritional years-long conflict, got to?
Well, I mean, we've seen Russian forces take an average of around 20 to 25 kilometres in almost as many months. And that is why there is a frustration when you hear the argument that, well, Russia can just keep going. I mean, that may be a belief in Moscow. But what that has meant is, you know, cities that we as a team have gone to countless times, Kramatorsk, Kupiansk, Kostantinivka, these are places that flank the eastern part of Ukraine's controlled territory. We now can't go there because of the level of risk, because of the proximity of Russian forces. And you think about the people we've met, what has happened to them. They presumably had to evacuate. These places are flattened by artillery. Ultimately, the drones swarm the skies. Roads are covered in anti-drone netting. And that is the reality. And I was speaking to Mr. Slav Chernov, the Oscar-winning filmmaker, who's been, you know, recognized for his work in this war, And he said, look, this is my home we're talking about. To us, watching from afar, it's another scarred war zone. But this is where I'm from. These are homes. These are memories. And this is the trajectory this war is on. Those memories, those homes are evaporating. They are being destroyed.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv for the BBC. Thank you.
It is 20-7 now. One of two members of the US National Guard who was shot in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday has died in hospital overnight. Sarah Beckstrom was 20 years old. The Trump administration has said that it will re-examine green cards issued to people from 19 countries after it emerged that the attacker had come to the US from Afghanistan. But also in the last few hours, the president has posted on social media that he plans to permanently pause migration from what he calls all third world countries. Well, Sean Dilley, our North America correspondent, told me the latest.
It's truly shocking. I don't think there's ever a good time for any president to make an announcement about a 20-year-old losing their life in such violent circumstances. But you could hear the stress in the president's voice. You could hear the anger in the president's voice as he essentially was addressing the nation on Thanksgiving, having to announce that two parents had lost their daughter. She was in the Capitol protecting people. She was barely a street and a half away from the White House in one of the busiest tourist areas. And, you know, though we had a little bit of a hint when Gary, her father, had spoken to the New York Times just a few hours before, saying that he was there holding her hand, that he felt that the injuries were mortal and she wouldn't survive. But the pure horror of that on Thanksgiving cannot be overstated.
At Sean Dilley in Washington, D.C. So just in the last hour or two, President Trump has posted a series of posts on his social media network, Truth Social. He has put a picture on there of basically hundreds of Afghans aboard a military plane. And the caption that he's written says, "This is part of the horrendous airlift from Afghanistan. Hundreds of thousands of people poured into our country totally unvetted and unchecked." And then he goes on to this longer paragraph where he says, just to give you a couple of the main thoughts from that, "I will permanently pause," he says, "migration from all third world countries to allow the US system to fully recover." He says he will end all federal benefits and subsidies to non-citizens of our country, of the US. He says only reverse migration in capital letters can fully cure this situation. So some fallout, no doubt, to come from that as well.
18 minutes to 7. I'll just quickly whisk through some of the stories dominating front pages and inside pages. There's still a lot of fallout, as you'd expect, 48 hours on from the budget. So the Times leads with day one protection of workers abandoned. This is the PM facing a backlash over dismissal rights. We're going to be talking about that with Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, talking to her about child poverty as well at 10 past 8. Top of the Times, stealth taxes mean dismal living standards, say economists. The Eye also leads with this U-turn on worker rights. There's an interesting piece from Andrew Neil in the Daily Mail, page 11, where he says it's time to scrap the OBR. He says it's invented for the best of reasons. It has become a hindrance to good economic policy, not its guarantor. Its core product, medium-term economic forecasts, is not fit for purpose. We should revert to Treasury forecasts, as before 2010, with rigorous external scrutiny from a handful of respected outside bodies, such as the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And we'll be talking to the former boss of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Paul Johnson, to get his verdict on the budget at about 10 past seven.
Slightly different take from The Sun this morning. Anybody who's ever had a family member say something that's perhaps frustrated them might roll their eyes at this one. Britain's being fleeced by my niece is The Sun's headline, because they've spoken to Rachel Reeves's uncle Terry, who says he's not happy with the budget either. Also a really striking picture on the front of The Guardian this morning, something we're going to talk about after 7 o'clock. The death toll rising in the huge blaze around those tower blocks in Hong Kong. You can see all of the different buildings just charred and burned out, some flames still burning. At least 83 people killed, but hundreds still missing. We'll get the latest from Hong Kong after 7.
16 minutes to 7, a justice minister has told MPs they will just have to wait to find out if the government plans to restrict the right to trial by jury in England and Wales. Yesterday in Parliament, the Conservatives attacked leaked proposals, suggesting all but the most serious cases could in future be heard by judges alone. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Is restricting the right to trial by jury in England and Wales a bold and necessary step to deal with bulging court backlogs, or an assault on a centuries-old tradition?
Jury trials are fundamental to the justice system. They're fundamental to our democracy, and we must protect them. Not my words, those of the Justice Secretary himself. And this time, he was right. There is wisdom in 12 ordinary citizens pooling their collective experiences of the world. But now he's in government, he's doing the complete opposite.
That's the Conservative Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, berating David Lammy about reports that he's proposing to massively restrict the right to trial by jury to only the most serious cases, such as rape, murder or manslaughter. All other offences would be dealt with by a judge sitting alone or with two magistrates. David Lammy wasn't in the chamber to answer those complaints. Instead, it was another Justice Minister, Sarah Sackman, who pointed out that the Crown Court backlog stood at 80,000 cases.
A woman reporting a rape today in London to be told that her trial may not come on till 2029 to 2030. That is not justice at all. That is a consequence of allowing the Crown Court backlog to spiral out of control and doing nothing.
The government commissioned a review by the retired Court of Appeal judge Sir Brian Leveson to look at ways to cut the backlog. And Sarah Sackman said final decisions hadn't yet been made. For the Liberal Democrats, Jess Brown Fuller was surprised by the plan, given David Lammy's previous comments.
In a report he wrote, he called jury trials a success story of our justice system.
Yes, he did.
Juries are not the cause of the court backlog. That was complacency from the former government and a failure to grip the issue by this government, totally failing the victims that are currently waiting.
That 2017 report from David Lammy looking at issues facing ethnic minorities in the criminal justice system had also been read by Labour's Kim Johnson, who noted it.
Found that jury trials to be the only part of the justice system consistently free from racial bias, and with only 12% of justice from ethnic backgrounds, these proposals risk deepening disproportionality and undermining the confidence in the justice system.
The Green Party's Sian Berry was also worried.
With the government's attitude to migrants now expanding the political space for the racist far right, is the minister not concerned that building a toolkit for authoritarians out of digital ID, police, facial recognition and now cutting jury trials for apparently all charges that might be associated with dissent is incredibly dangerous?
The minister dismissed that, arguing that guaranteeing trials for victims was fair and progressive. The Labour MP Emma Foodie backed the plan and noted that where defendants had a choice about the court in which their case was heard, more and more of them were opting for a jury trial.
Now, at the same time, we know that the backlog was growing for the Crown Court. We know that there's delays in those cases then going to trial. And we know, therefore, that there are more people dropping out and being denied their justice and their day in court. Is it not clear that some people are gaming the system to be able to deny victims justice?
The minister, who's also a lawyer, relayed what judges and barristers told her.
It is not uncommon to watch career criminals opting for a jury trial when their matter could be heard in the magistrates, which have sufficient sentencing powers, literally laughing in the dock Why? Because they know that not just this Christmas, but the Christmas after that and the one after that, they will still be with their families without having faced trial, in the hope that witnesses pull out, the trial cracks, and that, frankly, justice isn't served.
A Conservative, Martin Vickers, was sceptical that the government's plan would ever make it into law.
Can I remind the minister that Tony Blair's administration brought forward very similar proposals, and in 2007, after a defeat in the House of Lords, they acknowledged defeat. Can the minister acknowledge that she too will have to admit defeat?
But Sarah Sackman reckoned times had changed and there was no way she'd have to give in.
That's Alicia McCarthy reporting. It's just coming round to 11 minutes to seven. Now, when the Chancellor sat down after delivering her budget in the House of Commons on Wednesday, the Leader of the Opposition rose to respond. And the speech that Kemi Badenoch delivered really caught the attention of many in Westminster because of its tone. Alongside the political attacks, there were a number of highly personal jibes at Rachel Reeves. She called her spineless, shameless and completely aimless. She accused her of wallowing in self-pity, of whining about mansplaining and misogyny. And yesterday, Kemi Badenoch sat down with Nick for the latest episode of his Political Thinking podcast, which you can find on BBC Sounds Now. You're going to hear some of what she had to say about welfare and about Nigel Farage. But first, Nick asked her about that budget speech and whether she hesitated at all over the decision to, as she put it, not pull any punches.
When I walked in for Prime Minister's questions, I thought, oh my goodness, she looks absolutely broken. This OBR leak must be very upsetting for her. You know, I'll pull my punches. And then she launched into the most extraordinary tirade against Conservatives in her own speech, the first speech. So she started it. So she started off very defensive. And I thought, well, I'm not pulling any punches now.
Some people loved it, but there were plenty of people who didn't like it at all. Do you understand why some people might hear that sort of thing and go, you know, too much, actually?
Well, you can't please everybody. But I also have to deal with barrage of abuse every single week at Prime Minister's questions. Prime Minister can get very personal. Labour MPs shouting. There's only 120 Conservatives. There's well over 400 Labour MPs. But I don't complain about it. I don't say it's misogyny or racism or anything like that. I took on a tough job and I've got to do it the way anybody else has to. And what I find unbelievably frustrating is that Rachel Reeves is the second most powerful person in the country. And she keeps acting like she's still at school and people are being mean to her.
This isn't the place to do a detailed analysis of the budget, but I am interested in the philosophy. I was very struck by something you said about welfare spending the other day. You quoted St. Paul in his advice to Timothy. Anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith, said St. Paul, and is worse than an unbeliever. Are you saying that welfare spending is not Christian?
Well, my message is, let's get people off welfare into work. Let us not leave debt for our children and grandchildren. That is the worst unfairness.
But is it unchristian to expect the state to do what your family or your household or your wider community should do for you?
Well, I mean, in early Christian times, there was no states or welfare. So I think that you can argue that, actually. The Christian tradition is about communities and families and charity, not about compulsory taxation in order to pay welfare. We need a party that still talks about personal responsibility. We are the only party that is talking about limiting welfare. Nigel Farage is very happy with what Rachel Reeves has done. He has the same policy.
You've caricatured him a bit there, haven't you? Yes, he disagreed with you on the two-child benefit cap, but he's a Thatcherite, isn't he? He wants to cut the state like you.
Yeah, well, where are his plans to do so? I mean, anybody can say that.
Well, he says he'll cut £25 billion in public spending.
Well, yeah, but he also had a big manifesto last year of all the things that he would cut, and he's now tossed that aside.
Yeah, well, maybe he's learning.
Well, if he is learning, he's learning from watching what I'm doing.
Do you think Reform UK supporters are Nazis?
No. And we didn't call them that either. It's a very, very interesting thing. This is another thing that Reform has in common with Labour. They love to dish it out. You tease them a little bit and then they start crying.
Tease them? I mean, yeah. As a Conservative Party chairman posts on X comparing Reform's new logo, a gold logo, with a Nazi badge.
Yeah, well, Reform,
is that teasing?
Reform puts out a golden badge and there's a link to a Wikipedia article saying, well, you know, Here are some other golden badges with an eyes emoji. Yes, it is teasing. Nobody called them Nazis. And the fact that they've been running around...
What was the part of Chapman
saying? He was saying you haven't even done your homework to see the historical, sort of allusions to what you're doing. That's all. That you haven't paid attention. We did not call them Nazis. We wouldn't do that. I don't think Reform are Nazis. I think that they are just very careless and they don't do their homework. They are a one-man band. We are a strong team.
Well, that was just a flavour of it. You can hear Nick's full conversation with Kemi Badenoch on BBC Sounds just now. Search Political Thinking, or you can listen here on Radio 4 at 5:30.
7 minutes to 7, one of the big stories from this week's budget, which is in danger of being somewhat missed, is what's happening with SEND provision. This is special educational needs. The Chancellor announced the government would take over full responsibility from local councils. But remember, this is England only. How much will it cost? Where will the money come from? Luke Sibietta is research fellow at the IFS and joins us now in the studio. Luke, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Just if you wouldn't mind, just explain to our listeners what was actually announced this week.
Well, what we learned this week from the budget is, so they'll be asked a massive public service by producing its own forecast for spending on SEND and funding. And that's shown that spending is actually growing a lot faster than we thought it was. So, for example, this year alone, we're seeing spending on SEND growing by about 14% in real terms. That's enormous. And as a result, we're seeing a gap between spending and funding of around £6 billion in 2028.
And the government is going to take that on from local councils because local councils are too skint.
Absolutely. So local councils will have built up a debt of around £14 billion by that, which the government hasn't yet said how it's going to deal with. But there's now going to be a gap of around £6 billion in 2028, which is now going to be central government's responsibility.
A 14% rise in a single year is, I mean, that's a huge amount. What is driving the sharp rise in SEND claims?
So we've seen a really rapid rise in spending on special needs over the last 8 years. And that's been driven by rising numbers of pupils with high cost education, health, and care plans. These are reserved
EHCPs.
Yeah. These are for pupils with the highest needs and provide for legally mandated forms of provision. So those numbers have been going up and pushing up spending, but that supply hasn't kept pace with demand. And that's pushed up costs. So, for example, lots of areas have run out of special school places and they've had to go out looking in the private sector for really expensive provision. And thirdly, that there are very few value for money tests in the system. So pupils can be eligible for provision if there's only a chance they may benefit from it. So it would be a strong case for introducing better value for money tests.
Is the rise in the number of these EHCPs owing to increased diagnosis of existing conditions, which years ago people said, this person's different, but they don't necessarily have special educational needs? Or, I mean, why is there this explosive growth in that number?
So lots of reasons, to be honest. So some of it is recognising needs that were probably already there and codifying them and better understanding them. There may be some genuine increases in need. And so, for example, we're seeing really big increases of pupils with speech, language and communication needs. That's more likely to reflect environmental factors.
Interesting. And so if you're a parent of a child that might just have had a recent diagnosis, you're concerned about trying to secure one of these things, is their current position that we've got this £6 billion black hole, the government presumably will fund it, but we don't currently know where the money's going to come from?
Yes, we don't know where the money's going to come from. So the government essentially has three options for filling this £6 billion black hole. So the first option could be slowing the growth in spending on special educational needs. Given the really rapid growth we've seen, that's kind of a natural first priority the government's going to want to address as part of its white paper in the new year. Secondly, it could top up the school's budget from existing government funding. Thirdly, it could raid mainstream schools' budgets by reducing mainstream school budgets to pay for high-need spending. Those last two options are difficult choices. So £6 billion is about 9% of the overall school's budget. So
huge.
Exactly. Asking the Chancellor for a 9% boost to the school's budget might be tricky. £6 billion is about 11% of mainstream school budgets. So trying to find the money there would also be tricky.
Okay, tricky. A lot of tricky choices for the Chancellor. Very, very useful background. Thank you very much indeed. Luke Sibietta, research fellow at the IFS. Thanks for coming in.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What?
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
It is 2 minutes to seven, and back to Simon King for the weather.
Indeed, yes, we've got some pretty windy weather this morning, especially across northern areas of the United Kingdom. Gusts up to 70, 75 miles an hour around the northern and western Isles. But further south, it's still quite breezy. So for eastern and southeastern areas of England, a bit of higher cloud this morning, but generally fairly bright, and it will be fairly sunny for much of this morning. The cloud, though, will increase into the afternoon. A few showers coming in right at the end of the day. Quite breezy, temperatures 12 to 13 degrees. Southwest England, Wales, northern England, quite a lot of dry and bright weather through this morning, but we will see an area of showers, quite heavy and thundery, moving into northwest England, North Wales over the next few hours, and those will move their way further south and eastward, and then there'll be some sunnier spells developing to northern England, Wales, southwest England later on into the afternoon. Pretty blustery conditions, especially around western coasts, highs of 9 to 12 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, sunny spells with blustery showers, highs of 9 or 10 degrees, and for Scotland, those strong winds continuing in northern Scotland, gusts 70, 75 miles an hour, gradually easing off during this afternoon. Heavy and thundery showers, they're moving into northwestern areas, merging into longer spells of rain for a time, drier towards the far south and east.
Thank you, Simon. This is Today with Amal Rajan and Anna Foster.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 28th of November. The headlines this morning: the government's U-turn on its manifesto commitment to offer all workers the right to claim unfair dismissal from day one in a job has been criticised by Labour MPs. President Trump has said he will permanently pause migration to the United States from what he called all third world countries. The Labour chair of a Commons committee has warned that lives could be put at risk by plans to cut thousands of jobs at the Foreign Office.
Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, after yesterday's migration figures, why are so many young people leaving Britain?
I've met some of my best friends here. I met my partner here. So just the quality of life, I've got no reason to go back to the UK at the moment.
And when did cats first become domesticated? New research suggests that it actually might be much more recently than we thought. But before that, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs over the government's decision to abandon a manifesto pledge to give workers protection from unfair dismissal from their first day in the job. Ministers now plan to introduce the right after 6 months, following opposition from the House of Lords. Business groups have backed the change, but a number of Labour backbenchers have expressed concern at what the Conservatives have described as another humiliating U-turn. Here's our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus.
What Labour had promised, the Middlesbrough MP Andy Macdonald said, was the biggest uplift to workers' rights in a generation. But what had been agreed now was a complete betrayal. The Poole MP Neil Duncan-Jordan said the Lords did not have primacy over a manifesto commitment and asked why the government had capitulated. At present, workers can only take their employer to a tribunal for unfair dismissal if they've been in the job for 2 years. The manifesto pledge was to make that available from day one. But with the Lords holding up the legislation, the government has got more than a dozen businesses and union groups, including the TUC, to agree to a compromise where the right will kick in after 6 months. Both sides say they have sought to cooperate so the bill can be passed. The government will be hoping the support from the unions will blunt the criticism from Labour MPs.
President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration to the US from what he called third world countries. In a lengthy social media post, he also said he would end all federal benefits to non-citizens and denaturalise migrants who undermine domestic tranquility. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
President Trump posted his comments hours after he announced the death of Sarah Beckstrom, one of two National Guards shot during an attack near the White House on Wednesday. Authorities say the suspected gunman is an Afghan national. The president's language is highly inflammatory. Mr. Trump says immigration policies have eroded living conditions for many Americans and claims most of the 53 million foreign nationals living in the US are, in his words, on welfare from failed nations or from prisons, mental institutions, gangs or drug cartels. Earlier, the US government said it intended to review the immigration status of green card holders from 19 countries who have previously been granted the permanent right to live and work in the US. Officials did not set out any details and haven't released any official list of countries whose nationals would be affected.
The Labour chair of the Commons International Development Committee has warned that plans to cut almost 2,000 staff at the Foreign Office could have life or death implications for some of the world's poorest people. Sarah Champion also said the UK's global reputation would be put at risk by the loss of expertise at the department. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The Foreign Office is in the process of shedding around a quarter of its UK-based staff, including a significant number of senior officials. The Labour MP, Sarah Champion, who chairs the International Development Committee, says lives could be at stake as a result, along with the UK's global reputation. In a letter to the Foreign Secretary, she says the department's failure to explain why it's cutting so many posts could lead to an exodus of staff, deterioration in morale, and possibly even represent a breach of employment protocol. And with the whole process being conducted by the department's top civil servant, Sir Ollie Robbins, Sarah Champion said the apparent lack of ministerial oversight was concerning. A Foreign Office spokesperson said the UK remained committed to international development, but that the department was transitioning to a leaner, more agile workforce.
The authorities in Hong Kong have announced that firefighting operations have ended at the territory's worst blaze in decades. At least 94 people are confirmed to have died in the fire, which engulfed several tower blocks and a housing complex. Almost 300 people are still unaccounted for. The BBC has discovered that more than 1,000 adopted children in the UK were returned to care in the past 5 years, with parents and whistleblowers highlighting a culture of blame and lies in the system. Some adoptive parents have told Phylum 4 Investigates that they were forced to hand back children because they didn't receive enough support. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
We spoke to more than 50 parents, most of whom said they felt they had no option than to return at least one child to care. Many reported that their children had complex issues which were not made clear when they were placed for adoption and were then denied subsequent support and blamed when they could no longer cope. A quarter had been arrested after their children made untrue allegations about them, while more than half said they experienced acute mental health difficulties because of the adoption experience. A whistleblower has highlighted a culture of social workers blaming adoptive parents for their children's difficulties. The Department for Education said support was in place to help adoptive families and keep them together where possible, and they aim to transform children's social care with future legislation.
Adoption, the Blame Game, is available now on BBC Sounds. A BBC investigation into breast cancer care provided by County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust has learned that more than 200 patients have been harmed since 2023. 43 patients suffered significant harm, and one death is also being examined. Our health correspondent Sharon Barber has more details.
The County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust is now reviewing the medical records of nearly 1,600 patients seen since 2023. But the BBC has learned that serious concerns about the Trust's care and treatment of breast cancer patients go back more than a decade. The Trust has apologised, and a new report says warnings about major concerns were ignored for many years. The former clinical lead for breast cancer at the Trust is no longer seeing patients while investigations take place. The Trust has stopped using two private clinics, which he ran, on its behalf, and which were paid nearly £6 million in the last 6 years. The Care Quality Commission is now involved. The Trust is asking concerned patients to call its helpline.
A new report suggests palliative care services in England are under severe strain and failing to meet people's needs. The research, commissioned by a committee of MPs, was prepared before the government announced this week that a new strategy for end-of-life services was being developed. Here's our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes.
Independent experts were asked by the Health and Social Care Committee to investigate the state of palliative care in England. They found a service that was fragmented, complex and underfunded, beset by staffing shortages and under strain. They say this makes it hard for families to plan ahead, and when a loved one does die, access to invaluable bereavement services is patchy. This matters because more people are choosing to die at home or in hospices and care homes, and yet most funding is still directed at hospitals. The government says its new strategy on end-of-life care, announced this week and due in the spring, will deliver a fundamental improvement for patients and their families.
Campaigners are trying to raise £12 million to save the farmhouse where Robert Burns wrote Auld Lang Syne. Ellisland Farm, which was built by Burns himself in 1788, is suffering from damp, decay and structural deterioration. Graham Satchell reports.
Burns wrote many of his most noted poems at Ellisland Farm, including Tam O'Shanter, My Heart's in the Highlands and Auld Lang Syne. He took inspiration from the rugged landscape and the nearby river. The banks of the Nith, he said, are as sweet poetic ground as any I ever saw. Campaigners want to fully restore the farm's buildings and plan to use the site to house the extensive Burns collection, which includes original drafts of his poems and letters, a restored flute and even some of his shopping lists. There are plans to create spaces where modern-day artists and musicians can come to work. The restoration will cost an estimated £12 million. Worth it, campaigners say, so Burns' work can never be forgot.
Graham Satchell reporting.
Jane, thank you so much. It is 9 minutes past seven. Well, we've had 48 hours or so to make sense of the budget. Let's dig into some of its implications with Paul Johnson, a familiar voice on this programme, former head of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, now senior advisor at Frontier Economics, and provost of the Queen's College in Oxford, who wrote a book called Follow the Money. Let's follow the money together. Good morning, Paul.
Morning.
We'll do this in three parts, shall we? The good, the bad and the ugly. But before that, a general thought. Do you discern a coherent long-term economic strategy from this week's budget?
It's quite hard to see one. I think if you take the two budgets together, what you see is a government that is spending a considerable amount more on public services. And last year we got quite a lot more on capital investment. I think that is part of their programme, part of their strategy to be supporting public services. On the tax side, there's really hard to see a strategy there other than raising as much money as they need to pay for those public services. I mean, we got last year claims there'll be no more tax increases and almost a promise not to freeze allowances and thresholds. And this year we got those allowance and threshold freezes. That looks ever so tactical. And then broadly speaking on growth, again, we have seen some sense of a strategy, planning reform, the capital spending and so on. But on the other hand, these increased regulations on employment, housing, minimum wages, increases in taxes on employers. So there are hints of strategies here and there, but then there tend to be tactical retreats as well, as we've seen, for example, on welfare spending, where there seemed to be a very clear strategy to try and rein that in, to not get rid of the two-child limit, to reduce disability benefit spending. And then that, of course, has all moved in the other direction as a result of this budget.
What do they get right, including on taxation of electric cars or transparency on SEND spending?
Yes, well, I think you've picked out two things there which they did absolutely get right. I think it's been clear for a long time that we were going to have to find some way of taxing driving electric cars. Otherwise, we'd lose something like £30 billion of tax revenue and a stop taxing the cost that road users create. Now, the Chancellor claimed that the cost was damage to the roads. The actual sort of externality in economic terms that road users create is through congestion. But you know, be that as it may, finding some way of putting something in place of petrol duty was always a long-term necessity. And you've just spoken to my former colleague, Luke Sabietta, who set out the issues on SEND spending, which was being...
Should you say, sorry, that's special educational needs.
Special educational needs, which have been hidden within council budgets up till now, which central government is taking some responsibility for. So all of that, I think, you know, there is good reason to commend the government for making those kinds of moves.
What do they get wrong, for instance, on the new council tax bans?
you're leading the witness here, rather.
Well, I've been reading your time. I've been reading your... there's been a certain note of asperity, if I may say, in your columns in the Times this week. And you've taken to Twitter/X with a vigour, which it was quite striking.
I think the way I'd identify the real problem is that it's very hard to see a sense of direction on tax policy. I mean, I really don't know what's going to come next year. And I'd rather fear, actually, that the Chancellor doesn't know what's going to come next year. Because if you look at what's happened, as I've already referred to the about turn on tax allowances and thresholds, we've got an increase in the rates of tax on savings income, landlords' income, and so on, where we need reform. The government claims that was a reform. It wasn't. It was a straightforward increase in taxes, which will reduce incentives to save and invest. Council tax and the whole taxation of housing needs reform. What we got was a sort of three additional rates bunged on top of the current system, which I think is probably a sticking plaster and actually a move sort of in the right direction, in the sense that the most valuable properties are significantly under tax. But it was a it really is just a sticking plaster rather than the real reform that we actually need. So, and we saw that across the tax system. I think you've got these sort of lots and lots of short-term tactical moves and no sense of long-term direction.
How damaging was that leak from the OBR?
It's hard to see that it was sort of economically damaging. I mean, nothing huge happened in the markets. It's obviously damaging to the OBR's reputation. We'll need to find out more about how that happened. Yeah. And I suspect they did the same as they've done every year, and something went wrong in the sense that somebody found it.
And do you think the OBR is too powerful?
I mean, actually, no, I don't. I mean, I think there are things that governments do which make the OBR look too powerful. For example, leave themselves very little space against their own fiscal rules. And actually, the big surprise of this budget was the OBR didn't actually change its fiscal forecast, despite all of the briefing that we seem to have had from the Treasury and elsewhere over the last several months. So if as a government you kind of put yourself in a position where tiny changes in forecasts result in you meeting the fiscal rules that you yourself have put in place, then the OBR does look extremely powerful. But if you provide yourself with a slightly more flexible set of fiscal rules and more headroom against those, then the OBR is not going to look anywhere near so powerful.
Paul Johnson, Provost of the Queen's College in Oxford, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's exactly 7:15. At least 128 people are now known to have been killed in a huge fire that engulfed a high-rise public housing complex in Hong Kong. It is now the territory's deadliest fire in its modern history. It's under control now. It had been burning for several days, but a number of people are still missing. And there is anger, too, amongst residents about how the fire could spread in such a dangerous and uncontrolled way. Well, William Langley is South China correspondent at the Financial Times in Hong Kong. William, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, nice to meet you.
You were at the scene yesterday. It is a really striking image of the smoke and the flames rising from those tower blocks in which so many people lived.
Yeah, it really is. There's a deep state of shock and disbelief that something like this could happen in such an affluent city like Hong Kong.
Has the firefighting effort gone to plan? We know we've seen before in tower block fires around the world how difficult it is to get people out in those circumstances. Have they managed to do what they were trying to do?
It's been very difficult for the firefighters, who have said that the intensity of the blaze and the fact that so many floors of these buildings were on fire made it very, very difficult to put the blaze out, but also to do search and rescue. It is under control now, and we are slowly seeing people get rescued, but it's been really challenging for them.
Is there any idea yet or any theory about what caused it?
Authorities are looking. They've honed in on renovations that were ongoing at the complex. So all the buildings in the complex were shrouded in bamboo scaffolding and meshing as they were undergoing renovations. Now, authorities say they suspect some of the materials used in those renovations were not up to fire safety standards, and they've actually made a number of arrests, initially three men, in relation to those renovations, and the city's anti-corruption authorities have just arrested another two people. So the contention is that a lot of the materials used in those renovations were not up to fire safety standards and were highly flammable, including things like styrofoam and netting that just really made this blaze much more rapid than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, and I know, William, that you've been meeting and speaking to some of the people who live there. Obviously, there's a huge number of people now whose homes have been destroyed in a place where housing is difficult to come across at the best of times. What are they going to do for those people?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are waiting and trying to answer just that question. As I say, there was a real sense of disbelief at the site. A lot of residents are just sat outside watching, you know, with big bags of their stuff. People are taking shelter in community shelters that have kind of opened up nearby. Some are staying with relatives, with friends. But there's a lot of questions for those people, and they'll want those to be answered as soon as possible.
William Langley, thank you for joining us. The Financial Times' South China correspondent who is in Hong Kong. It is 18 minutes past seven. Hot on the heels of the Chancellor's budget and after a surprise drop in sales last month, UK retailers will be looking to Black Friday for a much-needed boost. Fliss is back. It's today, the big day.
It is. Happy Black Friday to all who celebrate. Yeah, this is a really significant point in the retail calendar now. One of the key moments in the so-called golden quarter of Christmas shopping. Now, the latest data from the Office for National Statistics showed a fall in retail sales in October, and retailers' confidence hit a 17-year low in the lead up to the budget. That's according to a survey from the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI. So are retailers feeling optimistic today? Well, let's ask one. Andrew Murphy is the chief executive of The Entertainer, which has 160 toy shops across the UK. Andrew, good morning. Have customers been holding back their spending so far in November and October?
Morning. I think they have to some degree. Much like last year, we came through a pretty good summer. And then almost as soon as the pre-budget speculation started across media, and obviously in this case kind of prompted by government leaks, there definitely was some caution that took hold. So I'm not surprised about last month's BRC results. It certainly reflects what we saw. And it remains to be seen this week whether there's a kind of coiled spring rebound about to happen.
So is your sense that customers were waiting for Black Friday or waiting to see what was in the budget?
I think a bit of both, and it's probably not helpful that the budget was quite as late as it was. I think with Black Friday, customers, for understandable reason, want to wait and make sure they're going to get the very best deal that a retailer has to offer. And I think many of them will possibly have learned that the first offer is not necessarily going to be the best one.
Yeah, this is a good point, isn't it? Because Which? Looks into this every year. It found that in last year's Black Friday season, 8 out of 10 products were not at their best price. So do consumers still really believe in Black Friday, or are they a bit more sceptical?
Look, I think the consumer is largely led by the retailer on this. I mean, Black Friday didn't exist before 2013 in the UK, and retailers probably slightly haphazardly taught the customer what to expect. Now, consumers understand that there'll be offers pretty much throughout November. To some degree, some of the best ones will be left for the end of the month. In The Entertainer, what we do now is we do what we call overlay offers, where rather than making the customer anxious about the individual item price, we bundle up and say, look, buy three toys, you'll get one free. And we try and take away some of that anxiety by doing that. So that's the offer that we're running.
I have certainly seen a lot of Black Friday month deals being offered. Briefly then, Andrew, if you can, what are you expecting today at The Entertainer?
Well, online has performed fantastically for us since Black Friday deals went on, plus 50%. The high street, as in the literal high street, as opposed to malls and parks, not quite so strong. But the retail park's doing well. And so I expect today to be a very good day, possibly not a record setter because I think there is some caution among consumers, but still a good day.
Andrew Murphy, Chief Executive of The Entertainer, thank you very much.
And Fliss, thank you very much. 21 minutes past seven. What is the real story in the migration figures released yesterday? It's complicated, it's nuanced, it's muddied by the fact that the ONS, the Office for National Statistics, has changed the way that it collects some data since 2021. That affects our grasp of the underlying trends. What we can say is that there has been a near record exodus from the UK, and because the ONS now breaks down the emigration figures by age band for the first time, we can say that large and growing numbers of young people are leaving the UK, which perhaps is something of a verdict on their assessment of this country's prospects. 53% of the net outflow were aged 16 to 24, 46% of the net outflow were aged 25 to 34. Adriana is a 28-year-old teacher from South London who moved to the United Arab Emirates 5 years ago. She told us why she made the move.
I think just not feeling like I was drowning, like the way that I did in the UK. The work hours aren't as long. I remember when I used to teach in the UK, I would stay at school until like 6 o'clock sometimes. I've met some of my best friends here. I met my partner here. So just the quality of life, I've got no reason to go back to the UK at the moment. So yeah, I'll be there for the foreseeable.
Carl Williams is Research Director at the CPS, the Centre for Policy Studies, a centre-right think tank. He's been looking at the emigration figures and joins us now. Carl, good morning.
Good morning.
Just give us your overall assessment of these figures. What's the story they're telling us?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Office for National Statistics has relooked at its methodology for these things. It's found that the outflow of British nationals has been three times what was previously thought. So over the last 5 years, over 1.2 million people have left. Obviously, some people have returned, but it is still a big net outflow. And it is predominantly young people. That's not entirely surprising. Young people tend to be more likely to emigrate than older people. But the new data does sort of confirm this mountain of anecdotal evidence that's been building up over the last couple of years, that young people, ambitious young people, feel overtaxed under the pressures from cost of living, don't see a solution to that in the UK and have been moving abroad. As we just said, Dubai is one of those prime locations.
And what do we know about why? So not just why they're leaving, but where they're going to?
Yeah, so Dubai, I think I've seen some studies saying there might be between 180 and 250,000 Brits there. Australia is another big destination. And the big draw there seems to be for NHS workers. You get better working conditions, better pay. You might recall a couple of years ago that Australian health services were actually advertising for British doctors. And I think one of the underlying factors is these often sunnier places, slightly nicer places in some ways. But housing costs are cheaper, taxes crucially are lower, you keep more of what you earn. So if you are ambitious and hardworking, it can seem like a no-brainer, especially if you've got no family attachments in the UK.
This is my moment to invite you, Carl, to explain a meme that's kicking off at the moment. This is Nick, age 30. Would you just introduce the concept of Nick, age 30, to us?
Yeah, so Nick, age 30, is sort of...
It's not Nick Robinson, just in case anyone's...
maybe a sort of average graduate worker, might be working in the city, will be facing very high tax rates because will probably be an above-average earner. We'll be repaying a student loan, we'll be paying high housing costs. And the meme is, Nick's always got his head in his hands, he's crying because he realises where all his money's going. And his tax is going to sort of a fiscal transfer to older people for social care and NHS, which, of course, Nick is not using himself. It might be supporting people in social housing or on welfare. It might be going in foreign aid. So the meme is Nick crying into his hands as all this, all the money is sort of flowing away from him and he's left with very little.
So Nick, age 30, quote unquote, has become a sort of cultural idea to signify, and perhaps this is more prevalent at the moment on the right of British politics, but it doesn't necessarily need to be, the idea that we've got a brain drain. We're losing some of our best and brightest because of what life is like for, quote unquote, Nick, age 30. Just in terms of the overall reduction in net immigration, there's been what looks like a significant fall. To what extent do you think, Carl, that this Labour government owes a certain thanks to Rishi Sunak? Because there's a lag, isn't there? There's a delay from changes such as those that Sunak announced when he was Prime Minister to their effect being seen in the migration numbers.
Yeah, I think this is largely down to those changes that were brought in the first half of 2024. They were kind of the reforms proposed by Robert Jenrick and then implemented by James Cleverly. And yeah, it does take over a year for this to start to show up in the data. Labour have done their own reforms, which will start to show up soon as well. So they've abolished the health and care visa for social workers. But yeah, I think at the moment it is substantially a result of reforms that were pre-Labour.
Carl Williams from the Centre for Policy Studies, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It is almost exactly 27 minutes past seven. It's time for the sport. Mike's back. Morning.
Hello again, Anna. Australia have named an unchanged team for the second Ashes test, which starts next Thursday, meaning they'll once again be without their captain, fast bowler Pat Cummings. Meanwhile, in football, wins in the Europa League last night for Celtic, Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest. Defeat, though, for Crystal Palace in the Conference League. We now, though, are going to pull back a bit and talk some big picture stuff and hear from a man who's had a unique perspective on the growth of global sport. For the last four decades, Michael Payne has had a ringside seat as sport around the world went from being an amateur pastime with limited following to a multi-trillion dollar business. As head of marketing at the IOC in the 1980s, he's credited with turning the Olympic Games into a financial success through the television and sponsorship deals he negotiated. He went on to hold a similar senior position at Formula One. Well, I've been speaking to Michael and began by asking him if he could pinpoint just how and when sport became big business.
You had a few visionary leaders who thought, hang on, maybe there is something here in the sports business. One was Mark McCormack, who founded the agency IMG, and he suddenly thought, well, athletes, they're not being paid anything. Why aren't they treated like Hollywood actors and rock stars? You had Horst Dassler, who was the owner and president of Adidas, and he was struggling to continue to finance all of the sports federations because Adidas was the only source. And so he said, well, what if I could persuade companies like Coca-Cola to step up? And it was the very beginning. It was a wild west. There was no strategy. And in some cases, it was survival.
That was the big change, wasn't it? The moment big brands started to realize that if they associated themselves with sport and sports stars, that can make them big money.
Yeah, there was two pillars to it. One, as you rightly say, companies beginning to understand the power of sport as a marketing branding tool. And the other key pillar was the explosion on the television front, where countries went from having one or two TV stations to suddenly having upstarts, you know, led by Rupert Murdoch or Berlusconi coming along. And they used sport as a battering ram to force their way onto the market because they felt, well, people are passionate about sport. They have to tune in. And if we can give them more sport, we can launch a new TV channel.
And that, in part, has led to this phenomenon of international fandom, which is a concept you discuss in the book at length. And it is the case now, isn't it, in the 21st century, where you can be a fan of Manchester United watching every match from New Delhi. Sport is now globalised, and the fans of each sport, each team, wherever you are in the world, can live and breathe every moment.
Well, that's, I think, a key to the future and will continue to drive the explosive growth of sport, that you can be a fan anywhere around the world. And similarly, you can be a fan maybe of a sport like volleyball that wouldn't necessarily be making it onto the mainstream TV here in Britain, but you now have access to it. And in other countries, you know, like Poland or Japan, it may be outperforming football. Some people have called it the democratization of sport. Federations now have their own TV channels, and I don't think it's too far into the future where the single most important broadcaster is going to become the athlete. Because if the athlete already has up to a billion followers on Instagram, and the fans are no longer just interested about what happens on the field of play, but his whole lifestyle, there's going to be a sea change in who's controlling the power, the content. And so if you were Usain Bolt, the fan is going to say, well, who is Usain Bolt? How does he live his life? Does he have a dog? What's his family? Usain Bolt, or whichever footballer or tennis player you want, they are going to be in total control of their lifestyle content. And increasingly, that's what the fandom wants to have access to.
Fascinating. Chatting to Michael Payne. We will hear more from him in the next hour, and his book, Fast Tracks and Dark Deals, How Sport Became Business and Business Became Sport, is out now.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Meanwhile, here's what Nick, not age 30, but not far off, has been up to.
The political landscape is constantly changing. This year has been no exception.
I think we are in a very worrying space because we're on the edge of being a very, very divided nation.
My mission, however, has remained the same: to get inside the minds of the people who shape our world and who run our country.
We didn't have loads of money, and so she needed to make sure that everything that she was spending, she could afford.
Conversations that have mattered, that have gone beyond the headlines and those headline decisions. Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson. Discover the whole back catalogue right now on BBC Sounds.
Well, and right now on BBC Sounds is Nick's latest episode, in which he's spoken to Kemi Badenoch, leader of the opposition, about her. Well, he spoke to her after the budget, including about her response to the budget, which excited a lot of headlines. That's tomorrow afternoon at 5:30 on Radio 4, but if you're on BBC Sounds, you can find it now.
The weather today is going to be windy. It feels like the word sunshine is entirely out of the vocabulary at the moment. Variable cloud, showers at times for most of us, and rain in the south tonight.
Coming up at about 10 to 8, David Dimbleby will be on this programme talking to Anna and asking the question that his new series asks, which is, what is the monarchy for?
We'll be getting his views on that. It's interesting, actually. It's a very nuanced look at his many decades of reporting on that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news for us.
Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs over the government's decision to abandon a manifesto pledge to give workers protection from unfair dismissal from their first day in the job. Ministers now plan to introduce the right after 6 months. Business groups have backed the change, but several Labour backbenchers have expressed concern at what the Conservatives have called another humiliating U-turn. President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration from what he called third world countries after two National Guard soldiers were shot in Washington on Wednesday. Last night, he announced one of the soldiers, 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom, had died. The main suspect in the shooting is a 29-year-old man from Afghanistan. In the past half hour, the authorities in Hong Kong have said the number of people confirmed to have died in the territory's worst fire for decades has risen to 128. Around 200 people are still unaccounted for following the blaze, which engulfed several tower blocks in a housing complex. The Labour chair of the Commons International Development Committee has warned that plans to cut almost 2,000 staff at the Foreign Office could have life or death implications for some of the world's poorest people. Sarah Champion also said the UK's global reputation would be put at risk by the loss of expertise at the department. The Foreign Office said it was transitioning to a more agile workforce. It's emerged more than 1,000 adopted children in the UK were returned to care in the past 5 years, with parents and whistleblowers highlighting a culture of blame and lies in the system. Some adoptive parents have told Phylum 4 Investigates that they were forced to hand back children because they didn't receive enough support. The Department of Education said it aimed to transform children's social care with future legislation. A BBC investigation into breast cancer care provided by County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust has found that more than 200 patients have been harmed since 2023, including 43 who suffered significant harms. The Trust has apologised after warnings were missed and is asking concerned patients to call its helpline.
Thank you, Jane. It's 25 to 8. Labour has dropped a manifesto promise to give protection from unfair dismissal to all employees from their first day in a new job. It will come in at 6 months instead. It's something which businesses and the Conservatives as well were advocating. The government says that it's listened. It says it's taken those thoughts on board and made changes to stop the legislation getting delayed on its way through Parliament. But some Labour MPs are angry at the decision, with one calling it a complete betrayal of Labour's pre-election promises to voters. Well, let's discuss this first of all with Rachel Maskell, a Labour MP for York Central. Good morning.
Good morning.
The Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, is saying that this is not a breach of the manifesto. Do you think it is?
Well, I stood on a manifesto where we said we would put day one employment rights in place, and that did include unfair dismissals. So, of course, I am deeply disappointed to hear overnight that these changes have been made when we know that we'll be voting on them just in a week's time, and of course have already voted on them. And above all, we know that this is coming from the House of Lords, the unelected chamber of Parliament.
How will you vote? Because you've rebelled against the government whip before and you've lost the whip for doing it. Will you do that again this time on this point of principle?
Well, I hear several amendments that are going to be put down, and I want to see them and scrutinise them first to see what has been said. I also want the opportunity to speak to the trade unions so I can really understand where they're coming from. But above all, I think we've got to recognise the merits of this bill, the fact that it's going to get rid of fire and hire, it's going to have the zero-hour contracts removed. You know, we're going to see real improvement in employment rights. But when it comes to this issue of day one rights, it's really important. And above all, what I would say to employers, that they have nothing to fear from day one rights, but workers will have every reason to fear if an employer didn't want day one rights.
When you've done that work and that further research that you said you want to do, would you, if you're not happy with what you find out, would you be prepared to vote against the government on this?
Well, I want to talk to ministers about it, because when I was a trade union official, I represented many people who were dismissed just before they acquired their trade union rights. If we think about the Employment Relations Act, which brought down the unfair dismissal limit to 1 year, we often saw people leaving the workplace just under 1 year. And I think particularly about disabled people, we're trying to get disabled people into work, and yet we know that they're often caught in the revolving door. And as therefore I say to government, please do an impact assessment on the impact on disabled people. But I also want to hear from trade union members on the ground. Ultimately, trade unions aren't the general secretaries, it is the members. And it's really important that they have a say in the ultimate proposals which are going forward.
We're about to hear from the TUC. Do you believe that the trade unions have properly consulted their members on reaching this compromise?
Well, I don't think anyone's had any time to consult people. I haven't had time to talk to my constituents, although I did manage to speak to some trade unions last night when I heard these proposals coming through, and they were in disbelief because they have supported Labour up to this point, really recognising that we were on their side. And now they're saying, well, why aren't they on this crucial issue and looking at unfair dismissal? Because ultimately, employers will still be able to dismiss people because of fair dismissal, which looks at reasons of capability, conduct or redundancy, or indeed probational periods. But what it won't now, when it's unfair, when it has breached an employee's rights.
Rachel Maskell, thank you for joining us, the Labour MP for York Central. Well, Paul Novak's also on the line, General Secretary of the TUC. Good morning.
Morning, Anna.
Did you consult your members thoroughly and properly about making this decision?
Well, listen, unions are democratic organisations and they're constantly talking to their members and reflecting their concerns and their issues. It's important to remember, and I think Rachel set this out, this legislation has for months now been blocked by opposition peers in the House of Lords. We had the spectacle of hereditary peers denying rights to millions of low-paid workers, and there was a real danger with that extended ping-pong process that we would miss out on things like sick pay from day one, starting next April if this legislation didn't pass both houses of Parliament. I hope now that those peers will take a step back, respect the government's mandate and make sure this legislation gets on the statute book before Christmas and delivers real important rights for millions of workers up and down the country.
You said that you're constantly consulting your members and talking to them, but are you really genuinely confident that they're happy for you to make this decision on their behalf, all of them?
Well, listen, of course you can't. It's a trade union movement of 5.5 million people, and they're going to be real deeply held concerns, and including some unions who've got different views as well. And that's absolutely right, because we're a democratic movement. I think on the balance, though, we have to say the priority is getting this legislation, as I say, onto the statute books before Christmas. It's also important just to recognise, and clearly a six-month qualifying period is not a day one right. Other important day one rights will remain, including that access to sick pay, parental leave, and so on. The government will also get rid of the so-called light touch probation period. We had real concerns that effectively would have weakened that day one right. And they'll also remove the cap on unfair dismissal, the compensation that people get for unfair dismissal. Anna, this is a compromise, and I can't claim that a compromise will always get consensus, because clearly it won't. But the priority is getting this legislation onto the statute book.
You said back in September, you said, I'm never complacent. So there was the caveat. You said, but I'm confident that the government will deliver the bill and deliver it in full. You talked about how the Prime Minister looked you in the eye, talked about delivering the bill, said it would have an impact for generations to come. Has he let you down?
I wouldn't describe it as being let down. I mean, at the end of the day, this legislation, when it goes onto the statute book, will be the biggest upgrade to workers and union rights in a generation.
Was your confidence misplaced then?
I don't think it was misplaced.
But he hasn't delivered the bill in full.
There's been a step back on this one issue, but that step back balanced, as I said, by the getting rid of the probation period and also the lifting of the cap on compensation. But this will be a bill that delivers rights for millions of workers up and down the country. It will be the first time in a generation that a government has repealed anti-union legislation. And I'm confident when this bill gets onto the statute book that millions will enjoy a better working life as a direct result of it.
What happens if this still doesn't get through the Lords? Are you open to further compromise?
I don't think that our unions are in any mood for further compromise. I think that the government has listened to the House of Lords. It's now down to the House of Lords to respect the government's mandate to deliver this bill and deliver it in a timely way. And crucially, forget all of the politics and the politicking. What's most important is that millions of people get an upgrade in their basic rights at work. And that's got to be a thing worth fighting for.
Paul Novak, General Secretary of the TUC. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 17 minutes to 7. When and where did cats become domesticated? New DNA evidence is updating our understanding of the bond between sapiens and our feline friends. It appears we may have brought these self-reliant mammals into our homes just a few thousand years ago, rather than, for instance, 10,000 or more years ago. Professor Gregor Larson is Professor of Evolutionary Genomics at Oxford University and joins us now. Professor Larson, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. So two papers are being published today which are changing how we think about this, one in the journal Science, the other in Cell Genomics. What's their basic argument?
The basic argument is that the narrative that we've been telling ourselves about how cats became closely related with people that usually starts in the Levant at about 10,000 years ago is actually not quite right. That the whole time frame of cat domestication is much more recent. It's only about 3,500 or 4,000 years ago. And the spread across Europe is actually a very Roman phenomenon. And on top of that, by the time cats get to East Asia, there had been a local cat that had been living with people for about 3,000 years before it sort of stopped doing that. And then domestic cats that we know of arrived through the Silk Road.
Where did our earlier assumptions about when cats were domesticated come from? Where did the idea that it was 10,000 or more years ago come from?
There's a cat that is buried with some people on the island of Cyprus that dates to about 9,000 years ago. And so the assumption was that as people settled down with agriculture, they developed a lot of grain. Those grains needed storage. The storage then attracted the mice, and then the local wildcats were then attracted to those rodents. And that all sort of fit into a nice kind of story that involved like a Freakonomic story of kind of accidental cats really not liking us so much, but liking the rats and mice that were associated with the grain. And that proved to be a very compelling narrative, so much so that it became kind of entrenched within the literature. The problem with it was that if you look at the zooarchaeological record of the kind of animal remains that are found within archaeological sites for the following 5,000 years, you never see any cats whatsoever. So there was that kind of small hole in the narrative that if it was going to start then, you needed to have them afterward, and they just weren't there.
Don't let the lack of evidence get in the way of a cute story, though.
Absolutely not.
But do we have a sense then, based on that record, of why when we first did domesticate cats, albeit 3,000, 4,000 years ago rather than 10,000 years ago, why we domesticated cats? Was it because of their company or because they're the best rat catchers?
It's quite an interesting story because it turns out it was all happening in northern Africa around the time of the Egyptians, and they have a goddess called Best or Bestet, and people were making pilgrimages to a big temple, and she was initially depicted as a human kind of body but with a lion head, and then that shifts at about 4,000 years ago, where her head now becomes more what we would associate with a domestic cat, but it was kind of probably the wild cat in the region. And as people went to that temple to pay homage, they would bring a votive offering, but they would buy it there. And that votive offering, rather than being a candle that you would get now for a pound or so and put for a memory of somebody, it was a mummified cat. And so in order, you wouldn't bring the cat that you had from home. You wouldn't have had a cat at home. You would acquire one when you got there. And so in order to meet the demand for large numbers of mummified cats, they had to start producing a whole lot of cats, and solely to murder them and then mummify them so they could be placed at the within the temples. And that's really what kickstarted the entire process, because in order to get that many cats, you have to change their behavior in order to allow them to reproduce in close proximity to one another, simply to add to the production for the mummification process.
Absolutely riveting. Professor Gregor Larson, Professor of Evolutionary Genomics at Oxford University, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? It's 14 minutes to 8. Now it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Canon Angela Tilby, Canon Emeritus of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford.
Good morning. This week saw the beginning of this year's Wreath Lectures, in which the Dutch historian Rutger Bregman is calling for a moral revolution. This annual lecture series is a chance to hear a distinguished person speak philosophically on a subject which concerns us all. The lectures are named after the BBC's founder, John Wreath, who believed it was the BBC's mission not only to inform and entertain, but also to educate the public, to help us gain not only knowledge, but wisdom. I remember an inspiring series by Atul Gawande on the future of medicine, in which he invited us to confront our mortality. And then there was Mark Carney's series on financial value and human value. The lectures which had the most impact on me were by Honora O'Neill in 2002, titled A Question of Trust. She discussed why it was that our society, both as individuals and institutions, had become so lacking in trust. Though she was speaking over 20 years ago, the issue has become even more urgent today. Only yesterday, on this programme, the Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride was lamenting the lack of trust in our institutions. Honora O'Neill argued that our problem with trust was that we'd come to put our faith not in each other, but in processes. Analysing problems, constructing rules, monitoring behaviour, keeping records. All this is important, of course, especially if you're flying a plane or working in an operating theatre. But trust involves something different, which goes beyond paperwork. It's a kind of faith in the integrity of others, the belief that others are capable of behaving with more than their own interests in mind. It's much more risky, of course, and can be betrayed, but paperwork can be falsified and conversations denied. Trust, at best, is a virtue, and it's demanding of ourselves and others. Often it's when others instinctively trust us that we're inspired to trust them. On Sunday, the Church begins the season of Advent, a time of looking forward in hope for the coming of Christ. Much of the imagery of the Advent season calls on the experience of Israel in exile, as described by the Old Testament prophets. The prophets speak of restoration, of salvation. Everything depends on trust. Trust in God and a rejection of false gods. Trust that a good life is possible in a homeland which is a real home. The hope for restoration will put things right between people and nations, between friends and neighbours, and between humanity and God. Trust, ultimately, is an essential ingredient of wisdom, that quality that John Reith hoped that his new broadcasting organisation would come to bestow on its audience.
And how long, what's next, the weather forecast?
That is Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. It is just coming round to 10 to 8. A new series on the royal family starts next week on BBC Two. It is 3 episodes long and it's called What's the Monarchy For? It is presented by someone who knows the topic more richly and more deeply than most of us, David Dimbleby, who spent decades covering the most high-profile royal events. And he joins me in the studio. David, good morning.
Anna, good morning. I think it's BBC One, actually.
Is it BBC One?
Well, I hope so.
No, you're right. It
well,
is
that's
BBC
what they
One.
Told me.
You know, you're absolutely right.
It's nothing against BBC Two.
It's a good job you're here to correct me. What I find really fascinating is that, as we said there, you have spent so many years covering the monarchy, the royal family, these very high-profile events. But actually what this programme does is something slightly different because it appraises it in a way that we haven't really seen much of before.
Yes, I think you're probably right. I mean, my work with monarchy has always been on the institutions of monarchy, births, deaths and marriages, so to speak, jubilees and all that kind of thing, which is commenting on state events. And I'd done that for several years, I mean, 20, 30, 40 years, I can't remember. So what interested me was looking at the public opinion polls about monarchy. After the Queen's death, there seemed to be a slide in the support for monarchy. And statistics show that in Scotland and Wales, there's a slight majority against the idea, not in favour of a republic, but just not supporting monarchy. And I thought, actually, with a new king on the throne and a new Prince of Wales, it's a good moment just to look at the institution as a whole. So that's what we've done. I mean, I put the idea up to the BBC. I said, you know, we endlessly parade the monarchy, and then we have occasional sort of the Andrew interview, for instance, or Bashir's interview with Diana, when we go off-piste. But we've never looked at the institution, and it seems to me a very good moment to do it. And I'm spurred on, actually, by what William himself has said on the record, which is, change is on my agenda. And I thought, change, yes, what kind of change? Is the monarchy, as it stands, fit for 21st century Britain, or are there things that need to be looked at? Mm. That's my starting point.
Well, and you do examine this and you break it down in various different themes over 3 episodes and really dig very deeply into where the positives might be and where the negatives might be as well.
We look at, I put up the 3 ideas as power, money and image, and they seem to me the 3 central points. Power is influence of the king or the queen, the king, influence and willingness to act. And we explored that particularly around Boris Johnson trying to prorogue Parliament and the Queen agreeing to it and then the Supreme Court saying it was an unlawful request. We look at money, which is really interesting, because they are very, very rich. King's the first billionaire king we've ever had, and they have a load of concessions about money, the tax that they pay voluntarily, taxes they don't pay. And I look at all that and the workings of the duchy and the way that money is spent and how the duchies operate. It's all contentious matters that people have looked into, but I think is interesting. And the privileges they have in terms of being able to see legislation that may affect them and occasionally say, you know, this doesn't suit us, could we possibly see changes, which they've done. They don't have to show, for instance, their shareholdings. Ted Heath gave them that concession. They have a very beneficial support system that George Osborne put in, which we analysed. And then, crucially, image, because ever since Queen Victoria, monarchs have worked, of course, on how they're perceived by the people of Britain. And so we've looked at the ways they've tried to adjust their image and the problems they have with image and how they go about that.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you? Again, as somebody who knows this topic far better than most of us do, was there anything that particularly surprised you as you went through that analytical process?
Oh, almost everything surprised me, because I'd never really looked at it in depth. Mm. And we had wonderful interviews with the most senior members of the palace hierarchy, the private secretaries to the Queen, about moments when they thought they'd got it a bit wrong. Diana's death, for instance, when they have a wonderful way of talking about it. We were a bit behind the curve. The people are actually working with the monarch to make the monarchy something that a majority of people in Britain want. I mean, we obviously talk about republicanism, which is a minority interest, and I'm curious about that too, because I think what William's on about is, if the monarchy is to remain popular in the future, it has got to make changes. There's got to be some radical alterations. I don't know what he's thinking of, but we posit one or two in the thing. But the idea of a republic, I was thinking about it. To find a president that would suit England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, I'm not sure it's as easy as the Republican movement thinks. So I suspect our future is a monarchy, but it does need to be a monarchy that fits the 21st century. It can't be one that's just, you know, flamboyant display of power and wealth. It's got to change in some ways so that it's more in tune with a country that, after all, is no longer top dog and maybe can no longer quite sustain that level of grandeur.
It's interesting. I think it's really fascinating as well, where you talk about it's an institution that has in many ways so much power, in some ways none at all, and it's how that's balanced and used for the good of the nation.
Well, the great conundrum is Charles, the present king, of course, because there's a wonderful moment in this film. I mean, when he was Prince of Wales, we know he sounded off about all sorts of things, architecture and homeopathy and you name it, and sustainability, very good causes. And then there's a wonderful little interview where he doesn't quite say he'll abandon it when he becomes king. He says he'd try to abandon it. And I'm interested that he may not quite have abandoned it. And I'm curious about the role that he plays. But as I say, William certainly seems to take a different view. We don't yet know what it is.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I'm looking forward to it. It's on Tuesday night, the first one of three, as we were saying, 9 o'clock on BBC One. You'll be able to find all of the episodes on the BBC iPlayer as well. David Dimbleby, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
It's just 3 minutes to eight, and Alex Forsyth can tell us what's coming up on Any Questions this evening. Hi, Alex.
Hello, morning, Amol. Tonight we will find out what the people of Walthamstow in East London make of all that has happened this week, including, of course, the budget. And on our panel to address their questions, we have the Economic Secretary to the Treasury, Lucy Rigby. We also have the Shadow Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, Julia Lopez, the Liberal Democrats' Deputy Leader and Treasury Spokesperson, Daisy Cooper, and the Times' Chief Political Commentator, Patrick Maguire. We are live at 8 p.m. or you can listen whenever suits you on BBC Sounds. Hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. A couple of minutes to eight now. Let's get the weather. Here's Simon.
Anna, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. It's pretty windy out there this morning, especially across the north and west of Scotland, where we've got some disruption at the moment because of the strong winds. Some showery rain as well for some of us today. But for southeast and eastern areas of England, it'll stay dry for much of the day, really. Only seeing some showers moving their way in here later on into this evening, probably after dark. And maximum temperatures getting to about 12 or 13 degrees Celsius with a rather gusty wind. For southwest England, Wales and of course northern England, quite a lot of dry weather this morning. Again, some bright spells, but we will see an area of showers moving into parts of north and west Wales, northwest England in the next few hours. Those will spread their way further south and eastward. They could turn heavy and even thundery for a time, but as they clear to the southeast, there'll be some sunny spells returning in northern England and across Wales. Strong winds, especially around western areas of England and Wales, and temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland today, a mixture of sunny spells and blustery showers, highs of 9 or 10 Celsius. And across Scotland, well, this is where we've got those strong winds, particularly in the north and the west, gusting up to 75, 80 miles an hour at the moment. Those winds will gradually ease down as we go through this afternoon, but we've also got some heavy showers, some thunderstorms moving in, merging into longer spells of rain in the north and the west, a bit drier towards southern and eastern areas, highs of 6 to 9 Celsius. Now then, into the weekend, it will start off quite cold and frosty across the northeast of Scotland. But actually for Scotland and Northern Ireland, plenty of dry weather with some sunshine on Saturday. But across England and Wales, there is still some uncertainty and disagreement with our computer models for the forecast, especially for the app and the website, which may well change. But generally, we're going to see rain moving its way in across England and Wales throughout Saturday. That could be quite heavy and persistent in some areas. Temperatures across England and Wales, about 7 to 12 degrees Celsius. But as I said, with that drier, sunny weather across Scotland, it will be chillier at 3 to 7 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Amol Rajan in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday the 28th of November. The headlines this morning, Labour MPs have expressed anger at the removal of an immediate protection against unfair dismissal from the Employment Rights Bill in a U-turn that breaches the government's election manifesto. President Trump has announced he'll suspend entry to the US from what he called third world countries after the death of a soldier allegedly shot by an Afghan national in Washington. And the number of people killed in Hong Kong's worst fire in decades has risen to at least 128.
Coming up in the next hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Blind Date. And here is your host, Miss Cilla Black.
Yes, it's four decades since Blind Date first aired. We'll speak to the couple who married after meeting on the show and 34 years later are still together. Plus, the Education and Women and Equalities Minister, so Secretary of State Bridget Phillipson, will join us after the news, which is read by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs over the government's decision to abandon a manifesto pledge to give workers protection from unfair dismissal from their first day in the job. Ministers now plan to introduce the right after 6 months, following opposition from the House of Lords. Business groups have backed the change, but a number of Labour backbenchers have expressed concern at what the Conservatives have described as another humiliating U-turn. Here's our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus.
What Labour had promised, the Middlesbrough MP Andy Macdonald said, was the biggest uplift to workers' rights in a generation. But what had been agreed now was a complete betrayal. The Poole MP Neil Duncan Jordan said the Lords did not have primacy over a manifesto commitment and asked why the government had capitulated. At present, workers can only take their employer to a tribunal for unfair dismissal if they've been in the job for 2 years. The manifesto pledge was to make that available from day one. But with the Lords holding up the legislation, the government has got more than a dozen businesses and union groups, including the TUC, to agree to a compromise where the right will kick in after 6 months. Both sides say they have sought to cooperate so the bill can be passed. The government will be hoping the support from the unions will blunt the criticism from Labour MPs.
The Labour MP for York Central, Rachel Maskell, told us she didn't agree with the decision.
I stood on a manifesto where we said we would put day one employment rights in place, and that did include unfair dismissals. So, of course, I'm deeply disappointed to hear overnight that these changes have been made when we know that we'll be voting on them just in a week's time. And, of course, have already voted on them. And we know that this is coming from the House of Lords, the unelected chamber of Parliament.
President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration to the US from what he called third world countries. In a lengthy social media post, he also said he would end all federal benefits to non-citizens and denaturalise migrants who undermine domestic tranquility. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
President Trump posted his comments hours after he announced the death of Sarah Beckstrom, one of two National Guards shot during an attack near the White House on Wednesday. Authorities say the suspected gunman is an Afghan national. The president's language is highly inflammatory. Mr. Trump says immigration policies have eroded living conditions for many Americans and claims most of the 53 million foreign nationals living in the US are, in his words, on welfare from failed nations or from prisons, mental institutions, gangs or drug cartels. Earlier, the US government said it intended to review the immigration status of green card holders from 19 countries who have previously been granted the permanent right to live and work in the US. Officials did not set out any details and haven't released any official list of countries whose nationals would be affected.
The number of people now known to have died in a huge fire which ripped through several tower blocks in Hong Kong has risen to 128. The authorities say that fire alarms in the affected buildings were not working properly. From Hong Kong, here's Danny Vincent.
3 days on from the start of the fire, around 200 people remain unaccounted for. There are fears that those missing did not survive the blaze, which engulfed the public housing estate. There's a mixture of sorrow and increasing anger. Many residents are now questioning if substandard building materials led to the fire spreading so quickly. The authorities have arrested two directors of a construction company, as well as an engineering consultant, on suspicion of manslaughter.
The Labour chair of the Commons International Development Committee has warned that plans to cut almost 2,000 staff at the Foreign Office could have life or death implications for some of the world's poorest people. Sarah Champion also said the UK's global reputation would be put at risk by the loss of expertise at the department. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The Foreign Office is in the process of shedding around a quarter of its UK-based staff, including a significant number of senior officials. The Labour MP, Sarah Champion, who chairs the International Development Committee, says lives could be at stake as a result, along with the UK's global reputation. In a letter to the Foreign Secretary, she says the department's failure to explain why it's cutting so many posts could lead to an exodus of staff, deterioration in morale, and possibly even represent a breach of employment protocol. And with the whole process being conducted by the department's top civil servant, Sir Ollie Robbins, Sarah Champion said the apparent lack of ministerial oversight was concerning. A Foreign Office spokesperson said the UK remained committed to international development, but that the department was transitioning to a leaner, more agile workforce.
The BBC has discovered that more than 1,000 adopted children in the UK were returned to care in the past 5 years, with parents and whistleblowers highlighting a culture of blame and lies in the system. Some adoptive parents have told File on 4 Investigates that they were forced to hand back children because they didn't receive enough support. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
We spoke to more than 50 parents, most of whom said they felt they had no option than to return at least one child to care. Many reported that their children had complex issues which were not made clear when they were placed for adoption and were then denied subsequent support and blamed when they could no longer cope. A quarter had been arrested after their children made untrue allegations about them, while more than half said they experienced acute mental health difficulties because of the adoption experience. A whistleblower has highlighted a culture of social workers blaming adoptive parents for their children's difficulties. The Department for Education said support was in place to help adoptive families and keep them together where possible, and they aim to transform children's social care with future legislation.
Adoption, the Blame Game, is available now on BBC Sounds. A BBC investigation into breast cancer care provided by County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust has learned that more than 200 patients have been harmed since 2023. 43 patients suffered significant harm and one death is also being examined. Our health correspondent Sharon Barber has more details.
The County Durham and Darlington NHS Trust is now reviewing the medical records of nearly 1,600 patients seen since 2023. But the BBC has learned that serious concerns about the Trust's care and treatment of breast cancer patients go back more than a decade. The Trust has apologised, and a new report says warnings about major concerns were ignored for many years. The former clinical lead for breast cancer at the Trust is no longer seeing patients while investigations take place. The Trust has stopped using two private clinics, which he ran on its behalf and which were paid nearly £6 million in the last 6 years. The Care Quality Commission is now involved. The Trust is asking concerned patients to call its helpline.
A prominent former Brexit Party MEP has denied taking large payments as part of a pro-Russian influence campaign in the European Parliament. Evidence presented in court shows cash was made available for David Coburn by a man accused of being the paymaster of Nathan Gill, the disgraced former Reform UK leader in Wales. Gill was jailed last week for more than 10 years after taking money for pro-Russia interviews and speeches. There is no evidence Mr. Coburn accepted or received cash. Our correspondent Wira Davis reports.
Last week, Nathan Gill was sentenced after pleading guilty to 8 charges of bribery, making speeches and giving interviews on behalf of pro-Russian interests in Ukraine. He was paid thousands via a man called Oleg Voloshin, who also asked him to find others to amplify the pro-Moscow narrative. Among those was a fellow MEP, David Coburn, a former UKIP and Brexit Party politician for Scotland. He made speeches similar to Gill, visited Ukraine and joined the board of a pro-Russian TV channel in the country. The BBC has now seen messages released by the CPS during Nathan Gill's sentencing, correspondence between Gill and Voloshin, which talked about payments being earmarked for Mr. Coburn. When asked by the BBC, he denied taking any money from either Nathan Gill or Oleg Voloshin.
New research suggests people in Europe may have begun adopting cats as pets much more recently than previously thought. It's been a long-held belief that cats were first domesticated as long ago as 10,000 years, when farmers from the Middle East first moved into Europe. But Professor Gregor Larsen from Oxford University told us there was now evidence to suggest it happened during ancient times.
The whole time frame of cat domestication is much more recent. It's only about 3,500 or 4,000 years ago. And the spread across Europe is actually a very Roman phenomenon. And on top of that, by the time cats get to East Asia, there had been a local cat that had been living with people for about 3,000 years before it sort of stopped doing that. And then domestic cats that we know of arrived through the Silk Road.
Professor Gregor Larsen speaking there.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. The time now is 10 past eight. We've often been told that reducing child poverty is one of the main missions of the present Labour government. It boasts the most state school educated and working class cabinet in British history. Several leading figures, including former Deputy Leader Angela Rayner, Health Secretary Wes Streeting and Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson, endured poverty as children. Many economists agree that, in the short term at least, abandoning the two-child limit on benefits would be the most fiscally efficient way of reducing child poverty. Nevertheless, most of the public have long supported the two-child limit, including a majority of putative Labour and Lib Dem voters. For the public, as for the Conservatives, abandoning the two-child limit was wrong on grounds of affordability, fairness or optimal bang for public buck. But Labour Party MPs wanted it gone, and Rachel Reeves gave them what they and she wanted. A long campaign by Gordon Brown and the Child Poverty Action Group proved influential. Those Labour MPs are proving somewhat obstreperous. Despite its huge working majority, Labour has had to U-turn on the winter fuel allowance, on signature welfare reforms, and now on workers' rights. A manifesto promised to give workers protection from unfair dismissal on day one was abandoned yesterday because it wasn't getting through the Lords. Workers will get those rights from 6 months instead. We're joined now by Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary. Good morning, Ms. Phillipson.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you so much, as ever, for joining us. Let's start with the workers' rights. Why have you had to abandon this manifesto promise?
So what we said in our manifesto is that we wanted to deliver important day one rights in a number of areas for workers across our country. And I'm incredibly proud that the Employment Rights Bill represents the biggest upgrades to workers' rights in a generation. Where it comes to the question of unfair dismissal that you've just mentioned, there's been discussion that's taken place between employers, trade unions and government in order to secure the passage of the Employment Rights Bill. Because of the change that's being set out, that has been consulted upon and discussed, it now means we can take the bill forward and that from April next year, millions of working people will have better rights at work around sick pay and parental leave. If we hadn't been able struggle to get to a settled position. It could have jeopardised the bill and delayed things further by another year, and we didn't want to see that happen.
But you said when you were campaigning to be deputy leader, and I quote, that you would ensure it is enacted in full and not watered down. No ifs or buts. It has had to be watered down, hasn't it?
I did say that. I said that when addressing TUC Congress, and TUC representing our trade unions have been involved in all of these discussions about taking forward the Employment Rights Bill. Unfair dismissal will be cut from a two-year current limit down to 6 months. That is a big step forward.
It's not day one, though, is it?
It's not day one, but it is day one where it comes to other important areas like sick pay, where many of the lowest paid workers in our country will see a huge boost to their rights at work, and that's worth fighting for.
Sure, but on unfair dismissal, given that you've got this majority of over 160, given your party was set up as the workers' representation in Parliament, don't you think it's reasonable for people who voted for you to think that you would enact every bit in full? And though you've got, I take your point that you've had to compromise, you've got most of what you wanted through, you haven't got this very important element of unfair dismissal through. And isn't that fundamentally reneging on a manifesto promise?
No, and sometimes in life you have to be pragmatic in order to secure wider benefits. And
but you said no ifs or buts.
Yeah, and the trade unions have been involved in this conversation in making sure we get to a good place and we deliver the big upgrades that are coming through the Employment Rights Bill. As I say, the risk was that there'd be further delay by another year. That's not something we wanted to see happen.
Let's talk about child poverty. I know that reducing child poverty is a huge passion of yours, owing in part to your own childhood. You chair the Child Poverty Action Group. Can I put to you really bluntly the argument of proponents or defenders of the two-child cap? They say, why should all taxpayers, many of whom who are struggling, some of whom choose not to have any children at all because they can't afford it, let alone have a second or third, why should they fund the unemployed or the low paid who do choose to have a third child? Why is that fair?
I would say very directly, why should that third child in a family suffer the injustice and hardship of child poverty because of decisions that were not taken by them? That's the reality of what happens at the moment. Tackling child poverty has always been very personal to me. It's always been a big and historic mission of this Labour Party to bring down child poverty. And I'm absolutely delighted that thanks to the measures we were taking in the budget around lifting the two-child limit, running alongside the biggest ever expansion of free school meals in a generation, 550,000 fewer children will be growing up in poverty thanks to this Labour government. That is the difference that Labour governments make. I'm incredibly proud that we've done that. It's through the work of the Child Poverty Task Force that we've made the case for change. It is the most effective way that we can lift children out of poverty. And sometimes when we have these discussions, you talk about the numbers, you talk about graphs, what this means. What this means is that at the moment, for millions of families across our country, they're worrying about how they're going to pay for the bills this winter. They're worrying about whether, as a parent, they're going to skip meals in order to make sure their children don't have to go without. That shames us as a country. It's a moral scar, and it's not an injustice we can allow to continue.
Of course, one understands the compassionate case, and take your point that the child born into that family doesn't make the choice. That's the nature of being born into a particular family. But most of the public have been historically, or since George Osborne introduced it, have been persuaded of the argument that the policy was unfair. Not that they sort of defend any discrimination against a child who doesn't choose the circumstances into which she or he is born, but that families who make certain choices are being unfairly penalised because they're having to fund other families who make different choices. And that fundamentally offends some sense of justice or fairness. That's not my view. It's the view of a majority of the public, including Labour voters, putative Labour voters, who defended the two-child limit.
This is unquestionably the right thing to do. And, you know, where you look at the impact that this has had on children, it's been devastating, but it's also had a deep and lasting impact on our economy and our society. We know that children who grow up in poverty are less likely to do well at school, less likely to be in paid work, more likely to end up in children's social care. So there is a big toll that we face economically and as a society because of child poverty. But just to give one example to bring this to life about what this means for families in our country, a constituent that I spoke to had three children. Her partner died, tragically, completely unexpectedly. They'd worked, they'd done the right thing, they'd planned to have a family of three children. And then this terrible event happens in her life and she finds out that she's not getting proper support for that third child. It's not defensible. We cannot defend it any longer.
A second argument against the change concerns value for money, bang for public buck. And the IFS argue that there is limited evidence that lifting the cap would improve school readiness. I'm sure you might dispute that. But many studies from the IFS and indeed the LSE concur with David Blunkett, who we spoke to on this programme yesterday, who, as you know, grew up in poverty in Sheffield, in saying that actually Sure Start centres under the new Labour government provided exceptional returns for individuals, neighbourhoods and the general taxpayer. When you've got finite public funds, it is a case of making choices. If you've got £3 or 4 billion to spend, wouldn't new Sure Start centres have been a better use?
Well, we are bringing Sure Start to life for a new generation through expanding Best Start family hubs across our country. So we're investing significant sums, rolling out 1,000 new Best Start family hubs across our country. That runs alongside the big changes we're making to children's social care, so more for support for families at an earlier point to stop problems escalating. But alongside that, we do have to tackle child poverty. It's not one or the other. It has to be all of that together. That, of course, was what the last Labour government did. They invested in Sure Start. The evidence is clear about the impact it had, but they also invested directly in families to lift children out of poverty. But actually, this Labour government will lift more children out of poverty in any parliament on record than any other government has done before. We will surpass the last Labour government, as things are expected to progress, in lifting children out of poverty. That is something we should be immensely proud of, because it's not just a deep moral injustice to those children. It shames our country. We are better than this as a country. We should be better than this as a country. And I cannot, in all good conscience, hear directly from families about the impact that poverty is having on their lives, on the outcomes for their children and on our economy, because it takes a big toll, and not take action. Okay. This was the right choice to make, the right thing to do. It is something where there is both a moral case for it and an economic case for it.
Can I ask you finally about SEND provision? This is special educational needs, and we're talking here specifically about England. There was a significant change this week. The OBR and perhaps the Treasury deserve some credit, according to a former boss of the IFS, Paul Johnson, for being much more transparent about SEND funding. But it does show a £6 billion black hole in SEND spending. SEND funding. At a time when the spending is growing by around about 14% a year. And lots of parents, including parents of children with disabilities, will be concerned about the implications for them. I know there are big reforms planned in the new year, but as the Education Secretary, can you offer any reassurance today to parents of children who rely on SEND provision, or those who work in schools who are worried that their budgets will be raided to pay for that £6 billion black hole?
Yes, I can provide that reassurance. And what I would say to parents, to teachers and others is that all of the change that we want to bring for support for children with SEND is to deliver better outcomes and a better education. And even if there weren't these pressures, the system we have at the moment just isn't working and needs to change. What the OBR did for the first time was to account for council deficits on the government balance sheet. So those deficits were there already. They'd built up over many years. This was something that we've inherited, but it's now on the government balance sheets. But what we've been clear about is that this won't be dealt with within the Department for Education through our core schools budget. This will be dealt with across government. So it is not government policy to absorb this from schools, to expect schools to make those cuts. That is not our position. And the Treasury document running alongside the OBR's document was very, very clear about that.
So the implication of that is that the £6 billion will come from other cuts in departmental spending, day-to-day spending?
Well, it's held in abeyance for now. So those deficits are frozen, in effect. This is something that we will have to return to at the next spending review, but this is not a question for now. And at the moment, right now, from this year, we are investing more in support for children with SEND. We are doing more to create high quality places closer to home, so parents don't have to send their children long distances to access the specialist provision that we need. So, as you said, we'll be setting out more detail next year through our school's white paper about longer term change. And we're working with parents, with disability rights groups and others to get this right. And we're spending a lot of time discussing the shape of the new system.
But you are going to have to spend a lot of money as well.
We are already investing more now in SEND budgets and in creating places through capital spending. So that work's underway. We're not waiting around for the white paper. But there are deeper questions about how the system works. And I think parents know it just isn't delivering what's needed for children.
But £6 billion is around about, as we were hearing from the IFS earlier on this programme, is about 10% of the school's budget. That money's going to have to be found. That's got big implications potentially for taxpayers.
And that's why it's not credible to suggest it would come from school budgets. And that's why we've been clear it won't be.
But you're not clear about where it will come from elsewhere in departmental spending, because you haven't made those decisions yet.
The Treasury set out in their document that it will come from overall government spending, and that's for a later spending review, not for now.
Bridget Phillipson, Education Secretary, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 22 minutes past eight now. Vladimir Putin says the future of Ukrainian land taken by Russia remains a key obstacle in trying to negotiate a peace deal to end the war. Russia wants territories that it has seized by force to be officially recognised as under its control. For Ukraine, which is being asked to cede even land that it still holds as part of a potential ceasefire deal, it is a difficult thing to agree to. A US-backed proposal which would give land to Russia has been worked on during high-level diplomatic talks this week, which has made it seemingly more acceptable to Kyiv, but those very changes will also make it less acceptable to Moscow. Well, I spoke earlier to Radek Sikorski, Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Poland, and asked how he assessed that US peace proposal.
Well, the US argues that in order to lure your other party into a negotiation, you have to give them something to chew on. The trouble with it is that I don't see where Russia's and Ukraine's red lines might possibly meet. But it's worth trying.
That is a good point, because particularly on the question of land and who is seen to legally own, or who is given legal recognition as the owner of that land, they are still a long way apart, aren't they? Do you think Ukraine will have to cede territory for peace?
Well, I'm not in the business of advising Ukraine. There is no shortage of pocket chamberlains that will do that. These are Ukrainian decisions, and there's just been an announcement by the head of Ukraine's presidential office that Ukraine won't do it for constitutional and other reasons.
I think it was more a question of, do you think Russia will settle for anything less than that?
Well, Russia originally argued that Ukraine is a friendly, brotherly nation, actually that they are just misguided Russians, and that they want to incorporate all of Ukraine into Russia. President Putin has repeatedly said that his war aims have not changed. So one wonders whether this is a genuine change of position, or whether he's just putting his war aims in stages.
Do you believe that we are any closer to a ceasefire than we were a week ago, 2 weeks ago?
One would hope so, because a lot of people are dying, hundreds of thousands, and Russia clearly wants to destroy Ukraine's electricity and heating systems ahead of the winter. What I would wish for is, of course, for Russia just to get out of Ukraine. But to achieve that, we need to increase the price. We need to increase the pressure on Putin.
And the pressure really wasn't increased by that document a week ago, was it? Where the US was showing that actually they were very prepared to take Russian demands into account. So it was doing the opposite of that.
Well, worse than that, it distracted attention from the issue at hand at that time, which was the delivery of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine.
Do you think that European leaders are being strong enough in public about this? Because they've had talks behind the scenes, and they acknowledged that initial document, the leaked document, but none of them have really publicly said this is not a good deal for Ukraine. This is very much a deal that looks controlled by Russia. They haven't come out and said that.
I think people have clarity on that. What is Europe's most urgent task is twofold. First of all, not to be distracted by this negotiation in keeping Ukraine's ability to resist Russia. So we should continue supplying the arms and ammunition. And secondly, what will increase Europe's bargaining position is taking hold of the frozen Russian assets. Russia wants them, obviously. Ukraine wants them. The United States wants them. And those assets can... when given to Ukraine, can persuade Putin that Ukraine has the resources to resist for 2 or 3 years. And when he realizes that, that's when he might recalibrate and limit his war aims.
Do you think that European leaders are
scared of angering and therefore losing Donald Trump in all of this?
Well, Donald Trump has his inimitable style. It sometimes works. He persuaded us Europeans to increase our defense spending. But I'm glad that the process is now into the procedures of diplomacy, and it's now more orderly.
That was a very diplomatic answer, Mr. Sikorski. I'm not sure it quite got to the heart of whether European leaders should be tougher and whether or not they fear that if they speak out with too much truth, too much honesty, too much clarity, that he might turn away from them and turn on Ukraine again, as we've seen him do before.
Well, the US still has some cards, as Donald Trump would put. The targeting data are important. The effectors for US equipment, Patriot missiles, TACAM missiles, Tomahawks, other types of munitions are important for Ukraine. And also, as you know, the dollar being the reserve currency, American sanctions on the clunker fleet or on refineries in China or India are particularly effective.
If this was wholly in your hands now, the decision about what to do next and how to try and end the war, what steps would you take?
Well, I would confiscate or at least secure the Russian frozen assets and increase the level of support for Ukraine. And then 6 months down the road, when Putin has sold his gold reserves to China, he might finally conclude that he cannot win this.
So you still think sanctions, financial pressure are the key to trying to get Moscow to concede?
Yes, I do. These colonial wars usually take a decade. Of course, it's a question when this war started. After a decade, Putin is still fighting in Donbass at the cost of hundreds of thousands of his soldiers. But they only end when the metropolis trying to recover its colony concludes that it cannot achieve this aim at an acceptable cost. And I don't believe Putin is there yet.
Radek Sikorski, thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
The European view there from Radek Sikorski. In Ukraine itself this morning, the main news is that anti-corruption investigators have been searching the house of President Zelensky's chief of staff. You remember there is that corruption investigation that is going on after government ministers siphoned off a lot of money from, hundreds of millions of dollars from Ukraine's energy sector. We will get an update on that in about 20 minutes time with our correspondent James Waterhouse in Kyiv.
Yes, indeed. 8:30. I should, of course, say that Bridget Phillipson is the co-chair of the Child Poverty Task Force, not the Child Poverty Action Group. It's 8:30 and Mike Williams is here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello again, Amal. Still no Pat Cummings for Australia. The captain has not been named in their squad for the second Ashes test, which starts next week. The fast bowler will travel with the team to Brisbane for the day-nighter at the Gabba, but is still recovering from a back injury. A reminder, the second Ashes test begins at 4 a.m. next Thursday morning. Now, though, time for part two of our special chat with the former head of marketing at the IOC, Michael Payne, the man credited with turning the Olympic Games into a financial success. We spoke last hour about how sports association with big brands changed the landscape forever and about the concept of international fandom. Now, Michael's been telling me about the growing role of sport in geopolitics. Why is it increasingly the case that governments of all forms around the world want to align themselves with global sport?
The opportunity to host the FIFA World Cup, the Olympic Games, becomes a point of national pride, the journey, the bidding process to win the rights. And some countries went to extreme lengths to make sure they would win. Whether that was engaging the full support of their security forces, whether it's very what would be perhaps diplomatically termed as creative lobbying. But to be honest, sport, I think, would be no different than if you were to go to the UN and you look at how countries lobby to get agreements through the UN, often held or tied to big trade deals, Well, if it was a trade deal done at the UN, people would say that's normal. If it was a trade deal done by a country to win the rights of a big event, oh, no, no, that's corruption. Sport goes under the magnifying glass in a way that, frankly, no company goes under the magnifying glass in the same sense. And, you know, as a result, the good and all the warts and challenges make headlines.
You mentioned politics and politicians. President Trump is a figure who looms over international sport, certainly over the next few years, the next two biggest global sporting events on the planet, the FIFA World Cup next year and the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles, will be on his watch, so to speak, in his country. Are officials and administrators associated with those two events, I'm thinking principally about the FIFA president Gianni Infantino, are they right to, for want of a better word, cozy up to the president as we've seen over the last few years? Is that healthy? Is that the way to do the kind of business and the deals that you reference?
I know a lot of the media debate has been questioning to say, is it right? I think if you're staging the world's largest event, whether it's the World Cup or the Olympics, you need the country and the government, and if you can, the head of state fully behind it. Because the operational logistics and complexity is mind-boggling. And if you have that responsibility and you've got a direct line to the president, frankly, that's very useful. I joined the IOC in the middle of the Cold War, and it was boycott era between the Soviets and America. You know, the sport was caught in the crossfire of the superpower politics. The IOC president at the time, Samaranch, did a phenomenal job to basically slay the boycott dragon. And for around 30 years, sport had a pretty smooth ride. Then things started to unravel with Ukraine. And if you look at today, you've got politicians from left, right, all over jumping on their soapbox and using sport to making a statement sort of that they, oh, we'll host the games at 3 months' notice, or we should ban that country or ban that athlete. So it's getting increasingly complicated and fraught as to how does sport stay out of the crossfires of the politics.
Final thought, struck by a quote where you describe global sport as being dismantled and rebuilt in real time. What do you mean by that? And do you say that with a positive inflection or one with a bit more pessimism?
No, I say it positive because sport means so much to society. It means so much to the fandom. They're passionate about it, whatever the sport is, whether it's watching it or playing it. But the governance of sport and how that could change, if you want a very provocative sort of suggestion, I've wagered within a decade, you could easily see the NFL make a hostile takeover of world rugby. If you were a company, it would be automatic. So the message to governance and world rugby, don't assume that your structure, which has served you for the last 100 years, is necessarily going to serve you for the next, because you've got private equity, sovereign wealth funds all wading in. Now, what you would hope is that sport doesn't lose its soul and finds its right way forward.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on the Today programme.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And Michael Payne's new book is called Fast Tracks and Dark Deals, How Sport Became Business and Business Became Sport. It's a fascinating read, and it is out now.
Thank you, Mike. It's 24 minutes to nine. Let's look ahead to 9 o'clock. Here's Lauren Laverne.
My castaway this week is the writer Sir Salman Rushdie, who says for him, creativity is key to optimism.
Writing books is an optimistic act. You know, you sit alone in a room for long periods of time doing something which you hope is going to please people. You know, and so that requires optimism. And you can't do it without that.
Sir Salman Rushdie, my castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Wow, should be a good one. 24 minutes to 9. The weather, it is windy today with variable cloud, showers at times for most, rain in the south tonight.
sounds glorious. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Backbench Labour MPs have expressed anger at the decision to remove an immediate protection against unfair dismissal from the Employment Rights Bill in a U-turn that breaches the party's election manifesto. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, told us the government sometimes had to be pragmatic in order to secure wider benefits. President Trump has said he will permanently pause all migration to the US from what he called third world countries. In a lengthy social media post, he also said he would end all federal benefits to non-citizens and denaturalise migrants who undermine domestic tranquility. The number of people now known to have died in a huge fire which ripped through several tower blocks in Hong Kong has risen to 128. The authorities say that fire alarms in the affected buildings were not working properly. Ukraine's anti-corruption authorities say they're searching the offices of President Zelensky's chief of staff, who's also head of the Ukrainian delegation for peace talks with Russia. In a statement, Andriy Yermak said he was fully cooperating with investigators.
Thank you, Jane. 22 minutes to nine now. When Labour wrote its manifesto for last year's election, a couple of key words were pushed to the fore and became really synonymous with what the party was promising to voters. One of them was change and another was growth. And in the week of the budget, that one, again, is being used really as the litmus test of whether Labour has lived up to its pre-election pledges. Businesses say that they are the big driver of growth, and in order to deliver it, they need support. So how are they feeling after seeing the Chancellor's numbers? Lord O'Neill joins us. Jim O'Neill, former chief economist of Goldman Sachs and former Treasury Minister. John Walsh is the CEO and founder of Bio and Me. And Karina Contini is the owner of Contini Restaurant in Edinburgh. Good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Karina, I'm going to start with you. I hope you don't mind me calling you the grassroots, but really the people who are out there on the front lines of business. What does this budget look like to you?
We're still trying to adjust to the budget of 2024. The impact of the national wage increase, the threshold on the national insurance, they are still being felt and we're still trying to adjust and absorb them. I mean, if we look at our sort of wage, I'm trying just to find a way to articulate this so people understand the pressure that sort of businesses like ours, we're a small family business. We've got maybe 130, 140 team, but that's relatively small compared to the grand scale of some of the big businesses that are able to absorb these changes. If you look at the last sort of 20 years of our trading, our wage bill has gone from about 28 to 33%. But in the last 2 to 3 years, that's jumped to over 40%. So we're having to make a massive, massive adjustment over the course of the last couple of years. And last year's change was still a shock that we're still trying to adjust to. So it's hard. We've not even got our heads around what the next April 2026 adjustments are going to have to be, because we're still trying to figure out how do we deal with these ones.
Yeah. John, what about you? What's your position having looked at the budget?
So I think my headline, I know it's a rather British way to put it, would be that no bad news is good news. So if we think back to the last budget, you know, and business did need to do its fair share then, but those increases in national insurance, in the packaging tax, also having to deal with inflation, made it really hard as a business to grow. And like Karina was saying, if I sort of put it in context for us as a small company, so we're a food manufacturer, we're a gut health food brand, we make granola and kefir, etc. And we have a team of 15 people. Now, 2 weeks ago, we signed off our budget for next year to grow that team from 15 to 23 people. Now, if there had been more taxes that had come through in the budget, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So if national insurance had gone up again by the same amount, we'd have had to take that down by two people. Same for packaging tax, which, by the way, is the right thing to do from a sustainability point of view. But it just means that we can't grow. And the best way to grow is to hire more people. So the fact there was no bad news, no more bad news, as it were, in the budget means we can now go ahead with that plan. And it means we'll carry on growing. Hopefully that's the plan. That's what we're aiming to do. So actually we're talking to the team yesterday. We're quietly encouraged by the budget.
Lord O'Neill, when you're looking at a landscape that includes businesses like Karina was describing, you know, family-run restaurants, and then you're looking all the way to market impact, will the government look at this budget and see it as a success? But it's less about that, really. There are so many people who need to look at it and see it as a success.
I mean, it seems pretty clear in the short term they do regard it as a success, because it was motivated by trying to not upset the market, and even more importantly, trying to restore some kind of weird, vague harmony in the Labour Party. But for the things that are ultimately relevant for your two guests from business and the rest of business and everybody else, I don't know whether the budget really changed much at all. It certainly didn't add a lot of new damage. But as evidenced by the OBR forecasts and how people like me think, there was nothing to get one excited about. This is going to actually confidently boost the future growth performance, living standards, and many other things that related to the five mission statements that seemed so powerful when they were elected.
What do you think it actually needed to have that level of impact?
As people talk about, I have talked a lot on and off to various advisors to the government and people in it. And on a personal basis, I really like them. But I think they need to become more confident and bolder and somehow lead their party and deal with the really obvious things that could significantly raise the growth trend. And it will involve challenges with their manifesto commitments, but just because they had one that sort of was a bit of a game so the Tories couldn't attack them on, if they really want to deliver on the mission statements and have a second term of office, they've got to stop mucking about, really.
Rachel Reeves got close, didn't she? She really got as flying a kite, and then a couple of days later walked it back again.
Well, I feel for Rachel, to be honest. It's my suspicion that because of the Labour sort of mad things, I think she basically got told you can't do what you were planning to do. I don't know whether that's true, but it feels that way to me. And I think they need to take on the triple lock, do something about welfare reform, rather than just play around political games with the so-called mansion tax, major property tax reform. All of these things the financial markets and forecasters would love, and it would open the door to indirectly small businesses like your other two guests feeling a lot happier about their future, in my view.
You're in a position where you have looked at things through the lens of an economist. As we said, you were former chief economist at Goldman Sachs. You've looked through the lens as a Treasury minister as well. So if you're in a position that we were discussing there where you have fiscal choices to make, but you also have political choices to make, which one trumps the other?
Well, you know, I have had that brief experience of being right in the middle of the Westminster bubble, but whether I'm a sort of reader of the political antennae is another matter. But given that they're still in a relatively early part of their political life, one would have thought you want to take the biggest amount of pain from the political consequences early on, especially if you have a large majority, because you've got another 3.5 years to prove the benefits of why you're doing it. And especially given other political forces, I note with great interest that people close to Farage are talking about dropping the triple lock, and the Tories are clearly shifting that way. I'm like, all right, everybody knows we have to stop this game of kidology with all 65 million of us in the country. Somebody's got to get on and do something about it, and the rewards will be there for everybody when it happens.
Just very briefly, John and Karina, sort of 10, 15 seconds each, what would be the one thing that would have helped, would have made a difference for you? Karina first.
I think if nothing had happened, it would have been at least a moment of confidence and stability, and allowed our customers to feel a little bit more stable and get excited about going out and enjoying good times and feel positive and contribute to the economy.
And John, what about you?
I think any measures that can help keep inflation down, because inflation on food is still going along at 5 or 6%, and we're working very hard to offset that and not pass it on to our consumers. But that probably talks to the long-term capital investments for energy, transport, etc., to try and, you know, get our real industrial strategy going.
Yeah, really appreciate it, all three. Thank you. John Walsh there, Karina Contini and Lord O'Neill.
Well, at 13 minutes to nine, let's go back to Ukraine and our correspondent James Waterhouse, who's in Kyiv, because there has been this, as we're reading, James, a raid on the house of President Zelensky's chief of staff by anti-corruption investigators. What's going on?
Yeah, we've just heard. This is Andriy Yermak, Ukraine's all-powerful chief of staff to President Zelensky. But his popularity has been nosediving from within his party, from other MPs and among the public, really, over what is seen as previously his growing power, but also his alleged connections. He is widely perceived to be linked to a huge corruption scandal where several senior figures are accused of siphoning $100 million off public infrastructure projects. There are secret recordings that have been released. So, you know, this is a figure central to Ukraine's negotiations for its future. And agents are raiding Andriy Yermak's home. He said he will fully cooperate. His lawyers are at his apartment here in Kyiv. This will be welcomed by many domestically, but in terms of Ukraine's negotiating position, I mean, the Russians are already talking this up, so it's quite a development.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv, we'll keep across that. I'm sure you'll be updating that over the course of the day for the BBC News website as well, if people want to follow that story. James, thank you.
This morning from 9, over on Radio 3 Unwind, Dr. Sian Williams has got some peaceful, some enriching harmonies lined up for you. Plus, and this is what I think, this is one for you, Amol, actually, and your lovely children,
oh,
an insight into how music can help us sleep.
I cannot
you
wait
might want to
listen.
play that for you and to them as well. It's on Radio 3 Unwind. It's on your digital radio next to Radio 3, or you can search Unwind on BBC Sounds.
Trouble is, if it's really good to listen to, you won't be able to go to sleep because it'll be such an arresting listen. Anyway, right, 11 minutes to 9, let's talk about the British left. The British left has always been host to splits and unlikely alliances, even the odd bout of infighting, hence the older Monty Python sketch about the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front. But things do seem particularly vociferous at the moment, with Jeremy Corbyn's new party on the scene, the Green Party clearly surging in the polls under new leader Zach Polanski, Plaid Cymru registering a recent win, of course the SNP and other parties, and in an era of great political volatility, where the two-party politics of the 20th century is clearly long gone, this does matter. What's the future, the immediate future of the British left? Let's talk to Andrew Fisher, who is Jeremy Corbyn's Director of Policy, and Caroline Lucas, former leader of the Green Party. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Andrew, could I just shamelessly ask you if you've got any insight into what is currently happening with Jeremy Corbyn's newish party, your party? Do you have a sense of where it's got to?
Well, it's having its founding conference in Liverpool this weekend. It was launched, or at least spoken of, a few months ago, and 750,000 people signed up to be involved with a great deal of enthusiasm. There's since been a bit of a falling out by the two major protagonists in it, Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana, which seems to have been, I wouldn't say patched up, but papered over at the moment. And let's see what happens with it. But they've certainly squandered a lot of that initial enthusiasm and goodwill that they had. And I think it was filling a void on the British left politically, which I think actually Zach Polanski of the Greens has filled probably more effectively in the last few months.
So what was that void? Just before I come to you, Caroline, what was the your party, or the Corbyn Sultana party, able to do that the Labour Party and pre-Polanski Green Party could not?
Well, I think
socialism?
There has been, yes, basically, there's been this huge gap. And you saw that a bit at the last general election when there was a credible challenger to the left of the Labour Party. They won, whether that was Carla Denyer in Bristol or Jeremy Corbyn as an independent in Islington. So there was this appetite that things need to change more radically. People are fed up with governments that don't act like they're on the side of the people. And I think when people speak to that, it resonates and people get elected.
Caroline, would you go along with that analysis, that there was a sort of vacancy for a socialist party, basically? And do you agree with Andrew that Zach Polanski is filling it rather well?
Well,
Well, I think Zach is clearly filling it extremely well. Our membership has gone up from 68,000 when he took over the leadership, and it's now over 175,000. So in terms of membership, in terms of the polling, we're anywhere around 15 to 16% in some of the polls now. And yes, there was this gaping hole on the left of Labour because Labour had moved so far to the right. And frankly, I don't think anybody voted Labour expecting to see them in a race to the bottom with reform over performative cruelty to refugees. I don't think people voted Labour expecting to see them push disabled people into poverty or to drive a coach and horses through environmental protections. And certainly no one voted Labour to see a government complicit in genocide in Gaza and criminalising protests. So I think there was a real backlash against those kinds of policies, together with a real hunger for some hope in the whole political dialogue and some sense of moral purpose. I think the Starmer government still suffers from having no real narrative, no real moral purpose. And even when they try, it lacks authenticity. So just this week, we had Rachel Reeves trying to make a moral argument about lifting the two-child benefit cap. But that's the same Rachel Reeves that just last year said that that cap was inevitable and that, you know, it was perfectly fine for the government to suspend some of their own backbenchers for taking exactly the same
and
position,
of course,
she seems to espouse.
She and the rest of the Labour Party would, of course, completely reject your characterisation of them. And they'd say they've done a huge amount on free school meals and breakfast clubs and so on. But before we get to their record, just do you think, Caroline, that the left needs a unifying idea? And if so, what should it be?
Well, I would say that any party that doesn't put climate and nature front and centre is part of the old politics, not the new. So I think any kind of idea around which we coalesce has got to have, yes, social justice and concern about the widening inequalities, but it also absolutely has to have environmental justice right at its heart.
A green thought. Andrew, can I end with you? Do you agree, Andrew, with the journalist Ash Sarkar? She argued in a recent book called Minority Rule that identity politics, a kind of cultural leaning, had been a sort of a bit of a dead end and a distraction for the left, and that what they should get back to is a laser-like focus on economics and really the politics of class.
Look, I think the dominant issue at the moment is undoubtedly the cost of living crisis. And if you look at what the left is calling for at the moment, whether that's people like Jeremy Corbyn, whether that's Zach Polanski or figures on the Labour left like John McDonnell and others, it's calling for things like rent controls, a wealth tax, public ownership, redistributive taxation. These are things that are pretty mainstream across Europe. In fact, if you look at the Spanish government at the moment, it's introduced a wealth tax, brought in rent controls, brought in price controls in some areas, has got a fairly liberal migration policy, and is the fastest growing economy in Europe at the moment. So, you know, these things can be done and people understand that they're being ripped off at the moment. You look at the record profits the banks are making in this country, I think 3 years running now. People are paying through the nose for their mortgages. Rents are going up. There's no regulation of landlords. You know, I think there's a lot more that could be done. And people are, I think, ambitious for a politics that kind of channels that frustration at the lack of action.
To be continued. Andrew Fisher and Caroline Lucas, thank you both very much indeed.
It's 5 to 9. It is also 40 years this weekend since the launch of Blind Date, the TV show that captivated the nation back in the 80s and 90s. 18 million viewers tuned in at the height of its popularity. It was huge and it paved the way for all kinds of reality TV and dating formats that followed in the decades afterwards. But most people will remember two particular individuals looking for love, Alex and Sue Tatham, who met on the show, got married, and are still together 34 years later. Alex and Sue, morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello. I mean, we have to, first of all, just remind ourselves of that moment. This is when you met on the show back in 1988.
I study accountancy mainly because it allows me to indulge in my passion for figures. What aspect of accountancy most interests you?
Well, if you're an accountant and a Tarzanogram, that must mean you go to work in a loincloth. And that's one figure I'd love to see.
Stand by, Alex. This is your blind date for this evening. And here she is. You chose the lovely number two. And that was Sue from West Midlands. Come in, Sue.
Oh, and Love Blossom, that was Blind Date from London Weekend Television. I mean, Alex and Sue, we should say, by the way, that your relationship, your wedding, became such a huge part of that show.
Well, it was the number one show in 1991.
And if you are the vicar or the best man, yeah, and you're broadcasting to 18 million people, it was a slightly more pressure on the speeches than there was normal.
What about the pressure? Which was more pressured? Was it the actual meet or was it the televised wedding?
The wedding wasn't pressured, was
it? No, not pressured at all. It was well televised, but they stayed well out of the way, really. And it was just a normal wedding service with a lot of people wearing their brightest colours and biggest hats.
Yeah, and a Goodyear blimp. Sweet. Yeah.
and of course, Scylla in the middle of it all, you know, doing her Scylla thing. It's at that moment when you first met, at what point in your relationship was it that you thought, actually, you know what, this is going to work?
Well, we started seeing each other, but lived 134.7 miles apart. So it was really weekend relationships and parties. But quite on, we realised we've got similar values and we like the same things and we just loved life and loved doing stuff. And it was great.
We had a wonderful relationship over the time, but I had my accountancy exams and I didn't pop the question until I'd passed my accountancy exams, which was critical, I think, to the whole thing. So at least Sue could be assured of a future. By the way, I haven't done any accountancy since, so that's a marvellous thing.
Sue, do you mind me asking, that was a rather brilliant and mischievous line about the loincloth. Did the producers write those lines for you, or did you just come up with them on the...
I came up with it. I had time to do it, by the way, and I can't tell you how many of my friends since said, did you really like his loincloth, or did you go into business with him? I mean, really?
And what have you discovered about the secret to a happy marriage, please? Silence.
No, well,
maybe that is the answer, by the way.
Just being easy with each other. It's just...
You'll have also both looked at each other, yeah, hoping that each other would answer that question.
Yeah, I think we did that.
But nevertheless, actually, the most important thing, I think, is that you have shared values, I think, in terms of how you grow together. And that's really how we started. As we walked off the set, we found that we were both scared of horses. And as we grew to love each other over the course of our courting relationship and the past 34 years, it has always been a sort of shared moment of how do we make sure that we are always happy and always speaking love to each other.
Do you still get recognised by people in the street?
Not very often, but it's always rather sweet when the lady in the supermarket says, I think I've seen you before somewhere.
You never know. It does happen, and it might happen today, I fear.
Many times, I think.
Today will be the day. And it means that you can't ever have a crossword in public. If people are looking at you, you've got to save it for when you get home.
No, we never save it. No, we don't have crosswords. We really don't. Yeah.
I don't think we ever have.
No, it's so easy, lovely.
Oh, well, look, congratulations. And, you know,